Hello and welcome to the Weekly Stuff Podcast. I'm Jonathan Lack.
And I'm Sean Chapman.
And we are here to talk about stuff this week on the show. We're going to shoot the shit.
Yeah, there's not a big main topic to talk about this time.
No, so we're going to do a bunch of little things. Some of them are going to be more serious than we usually maybe get into on this podcast, in that there have been some dark and sad things going on in some gaming and movie communities.
Yeah.
And we want to talk about that. But we also want to be silly and have some fun, because there's enough dark shit in the world. So we're going to speculate about... The Super NES Classic is coming out this week, so I'm going to do some wild speculation on the N64 Classic.
There we go.
One, because I just like to imagine what the fuck that thing would be.
Then what is are they still going to make the analog stick out of hardened chalk?
Yes.
That's my main question for that.
And we're going to talk about Destiny 2 a little bit more. We'll follow up on my thoughts on Metroid Samus Returns, which I have now beat twice. I had not even beat it once last week, so that's what I've been doing.
Yeah.
And yeah, we're just going to talk about stuff that's fun. So... yeah, we actually just got off of, to talk about housekeeping, Sean.
Yep.
You and I just recorded the Doctor Who bonus podcast for the month.
We did.
On Tomb of the Cybermen. It was really fun.
Yeah.
I loved recording that one.
It's a good podcast. It's a great Doctor Who story. If you haven't seen it yet, that's a good one to go to.
I think that'll be coming out tomorrow from when you guys are hearing this, so you'll be hearing those out of order. But that'll be coming out for patrons. So if you go to patreon.com/weeklystuffpodcast, do the $5 level, that's it, and you can listen to that a week early. And then we will get that into the main feed. That'll actually be, I guess, early October by the time that comes out. But we were a little late this month. But we'll be better next time when we do a third Doctor story.
Yeah.
So that'll all be fun. You can listen to that to hear what the third Doctor story we're talking about is. But that was a blast. So yeah, that's housekeeping. Let's see. Mario 64 has started going out for the public.
Yeah, it has.
We're going to have more episodes this week. So to finish off, we're going to have episodes 3 and 4 this week. Which 4 I still need to get to patrons, which means I actually still need to finish editing it. Been really busy. And then we need to shoot more Mario 64.
Yes, we do. We need to put that one in the bed.
There might be a little break between... Some episodes of Mario 64, because there's a lot going on.
Yeah.
But that's okay. We'll figure it out. It's a fun show to shoot. And now, like, I have been getting a good number of comments on moments where I've fucked up one of my favorite games of all time. So, it's fun, you know.
Yeah.
We all get our turn in the barrel.
It's a really fun one to watch for me. You know,
yeah,
to sit back and see this, like, how are you going to handle the penguin?
Yeah, so, you know, my little brother watches the Let's Plays as they come out public. I keep telling him, like, I can give you the videos. You
don't have true. To. Like, it's I like, can give you. You can get them totally unedited if you want. Like, you can just watch them.
Yeah.
They're right here.
But no, but he always wants to watch them as they come out public on YouTube, which is great. I like that he watches them. And he's basically just been coming into my room and just pointing at me and laughing for Mario 64, which is fair.
I mean, now you can appreciate that I don't do that to you while that happens. I'm trying to be very supportive.
I have to tell you, Sean, the Mario video are, on a technical level, actually much simpler to edit than the Halo ones. They have taken me way longer, because it's much harder for me to watch my own failings than to watch you mostly play Halo competently, but once in a while have trouble. So, there you go. Glimpse behind the curtain.
There we go.
Alright. But let's see. What do we have next on the outline here? I opened the wrong document. Yes, let's go ahead and jump into stuff. So, Sean, that was our housekeeping. Let's talk about some stuff. What stuff do you have going on?
Not a whole lot of stuff. I've been, you know, keeping up with my Destiny 2, just sort of like plucking away at that. It's a good game to just sort of like play a little bit every day, the way that Destiny 1 was. The one other thing is I started earlier today because I was like, oh, we're going to record a podcast. I need to have something else to talk about. And there's something I've been wanting to get back to for a while was No Man's Sky. Earlier in August, they released a huge update for No Man's Sky that added a new sort of like story campaign sort of element to that game. That was like the third of a series of really huge updates they've done since that game first came out. And I've always wanted to go back and see what a lot of those updates were. And I figured, I've got a little bit of downtime here. I'll take a little break from Destiny and play some No Man's Sky. And I haven't played that much of it. I only kind of like got off the first planet and got my warp. Because I made a new save because it had been a year since I played any of that game. So I was like, I don't want all my old stuff. I'm going to have no idea where the fuck I am. So I started a new save, got off the sort of first planet, got my warp cell and hyperdrive and sort of gone to the next point in the galaxy. And I have to say, they have fucking added a lot of stuff to that game. There's like building stuff now. At some point you can make vehicles. There's a whole other sort of... new different kinds of like huge cargo ships you can get and stuff like that. Obviously, I don't have any of that stuff yet, but I can sort of see it and see all the places they've added this stuff. The beginning of the game is much better at sort of giving you a sense of progression and a reason to go to some places. They have very clearly touched up a lot of the algorithms for how planets are put together and how animals are put together, because they're a lot more sort of dramatic. I went to an icy sort of like winter planet that I had never seen before when I played the game when it came out last year. And overall, like, I think it's something that if you bought No Man's Sky and kind of have fallen away from it and sort of haven't been paying much attention to it but still have it, like, I think it's 100% worth going back to, because I was really impressed by my like 90 minutes to 2 hours of playing that game earlier today, how much stuff they had added and how much more sort of like fully featured that game feels, because I still really enjoyed it when it came out, but I think there were obviously issues and holes in how that game was built. And this feels like the weird tragedy of if that game had been delayed for like 9 more months or something, which obviously would have been a huge ask, and this had been like the version of the game that first launched, it would have, I think, had a like a hugely successful launch. That's obviously not how that played out. But if you have No Man's Sky and were burned from it and didn't like it but did not give it back yet or something, or bought it digitally, like 100% go back to that game, because it is really impressive what they've done and I'm really enjoying it.
Yeah. You know, I need to do the same thing with ReCore on Xbox One.
Right, yes. Because now they've released ReCore the Definitive Edition, which is maybe the most pointed, barbed version of definitive I've heard for something.
Because basically they went in and finished the game.
Yeah.
Because ReCore was kind of like, for me, what No Man's Sky was for you last year, where you liked No Man's Score, No Man's Sky more than like the general...
I also like its score. Its score is very good. They added more music with the most recent patch as well.
Yes, but you liked it more than kind of the average, like, conventional wisdom did. Yeah. And I liked ReCore a lot more than I think the conventional wisdom did. But both were clearly unfinished games.
Yeah.
So I'd like to go back and try that too, and this, emerging trend of games that get finished a year later.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, it's better late than never.
Yeah, no, and it's something that, like, I had kind of forgotten just how peaceful and relaxing No Man's Sky is as a game, and it was something very nice. It was like, oh yeah, like, this is a guy, I can just walk around and take pictures of animals and get plutonium. Like, this is a very calming, like, I had kind of like a busy, stressful week, and it was like, this is a really nice way to decompress from all of that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm just gonna float in space for 5 minutes.
All right, so let's go ahead and... I had one piece of stuff to talk about here, and that was... I saw the new Kingsman movie the other day.
Oh, right.
Kingsman, the Golden Circle, and I need to say something about it before I forget what happened in the movie.
Okay.
Because it's very okay.
Okay.
My quick review of Kingsman, the Golden Circle is, if you liked the first movie, Kingsman, the Secret Service, you will probably enjoy this one and have fun with it, but you'll notice, like, it's not nearly as good.
Okay.
But worth seeing. It's fun. You know, I went to see it for like a $5 matinee. Totally worth it. So, you know, it's worth 2 hours of yucks. But then if you were lukewarm to one of the many people who like viscerally disliked Kingsman the Secret Service, Golden Circle will be nails on a chalkboard to you.
Okay.
So don't think that like maybe I'll like it more this time. You won't. You're not going to like it. I do think it has things worth recommending. It's got a phenomenal cast. The first one did. This one does, too. Julianne Moore is the villain this time, and she needs to be the villain in more movies, because
yeah, she's good.
You wouldn't normally think of Julianne Moore as the villain, but she's very good. Just basically kind of playing a Julianne Moore performance if she were crazy. But also, like, I could totally see her, if they ever want to do a female reboot of Silence of the Lambs, like, reversed, where she's...
Oh.
Where you have female Hannibal and male, like, FBI agent, she would make a great Hannibal.
Yeah, they should actually totally fucking do that. That would be gender-bent version of Silence of the Lambs. That would be fucking awesome.
That'd be fucking awesome, and she'd be really good in it, because there's some connections to Hannibal Lecter in this movie, let's say.
I feel like there has got to be at least, like, one time there has been a staged, like, theater performance that is a gender-flipped version of Silence of the Lambs. That must have happened at least once.
Brian Fuller is still thinking of doing another Hannibal thing. I think that should be it. Mads Mikkelsen plays the cop.
Yes.
And Julianne Moore is Hannibal. And just flip it. And now Mads Mikkelsen is like the good guy.
Maybe that was their plan for Silence of the Lambs all along for Hannibal. Like, that's totally plausible to me that that's where that show would have gone for another season. Like, we're going to do Silence of the Lambs, but you're not going to believe how we do it.
Yes. No. There could be a lot of great ways they could do that. But yeah, anyway, Julianne Moore is so great. And I wish they actually used her a little more, because she's a great villain. And the first movie had a great villain, with Samuel L. Jackson giving the funniest performance of his career, because he had a little lisp, and it makes me laugh my ass off. So anyway, the villains in these movies are really good. A lot of other good actors. We are introduced to the statesman in this movie, the American version of the Kingsman. They are not a tailor, they are a whiskey manufacturer, which is great. And you've got Channing Tatum as Tequila. You got Pedro Pascal from Game of Thrones as Whiskey, I think is that character's name. And Jeff Bridges is in three scenes as Champagne, but he goes by Champ. And I liked that. Jeff Bridges Jeff Bridges is great. Yeah. And just the Statesman. Oh, you also have Halle Berry in there, and she's really good, so that's fun. Getting another, like, a James Bond performer in there, which is cool. Let's see. And then you've got some of the returning actors. Honestly, as much as I love Colin Firth, and Colin Firth is a world treasure. He is a wonderful person.
Absolutely.
He was so great in the first Kingsman. This isn't a spoiler. It's in the trailers. He dies in the first Kingsman, and they had to bring him back here. And he's great in that first movie. I think bringing him back is the biggest mistake this movie made, because it really strains the second act of the movie, because his whole, like, resurrection and all this stuff really has nothing to do with the main plot with Julianne Moore. And it just, like, this movie is 2.5 hours long. It's way too long. It's really meandering. Like, if you want to play the exercise, where are the act breaks? It's very hard because it's so meandering. And part of that, I think, is that I don't know if the movie justifies having Colin Firth in it enough, when I actually think there could have been a much more interesting direction where you could take the main character, Eggsy, played by Taron Egerton, and maybe another one of the young Kingsman agents from the last movie, and put them together and maybe have that be more like a new generation coming, rather than bringing Colin Firth back and kind of restoring the status quo. I think that's problematic. Colin Firth is fun in this movie. He's good. But I think they kind of waste him in some ways, and I think the resurrection plot, it is very, I love how pulpy it is of how they get through him getting a bullet to the head. It made me laugh very hard, because it's the perfect kind of James Bondian explanation for that. It's basically they have a special gel that goes in his head, and it's hilarious, but it's great. But I think that might have been a mistake. But you do have also returning is Mark Strong, who played Merlin in the first movie, the codename Merlin, who's like the tech guy, like the Q of this universe. And Mark Strong is just one of the best and most underrated actors. I love him. Matthew Vaughn, the director, clearly loves Mark Strong. He has the best scene in this movie. And, like, there's a scene in this movie with Mark Strong near the end that makes the whole movie worth the price of admission and is fantastic. And I want Mark Strong to just get his own film series, because he's so great. There was that period where he, like, played villains in everything. And now he plays, like, I think in part because of the first Kingsman, like, very warm characters. And he's great in whatever mode. He's just a great actor. So you have a lot of stuff like that. I think Taron Egerton is good in this. Everyone's good in this movie. It's very meandering, as I said. It's too long. I think it tries to be subversive in some of the ways the first movie I found interestingly subversive, because it's very much, the first movie is all about kind of taking the James Bond logic to its natural endpoint extreme. And it's not always in good taste, but I found it fun and interesting. This movie, I think, does that with less success. It tries to do an interesting thing where it tries to explore some of, I think, the romantic and sexual politics of being a James Bond-esque secret agent, where the main character, Eggsy, is actually in a committed relationship now with the woman he got with at the end of the first movie as, like, a fling. Mm-hmm. And I wish they had committed to that more fully or done something better with that, because it feels half-hearted and ultimately might raise more gender and sexism problems than it solves. There's a scene, if you've seen the movie, you know what it is, where they kind of try to address, you know, the sleeping with a mark kind of thing that secret agents have to do in all these movies. And I get what they're going for. I think the movie's own sense of, like, we need to push this further undermines it completely. So, kind of a wash on that. And you know, there's some other things. That Julianne Moore's character, her whole plot, evil plot, basically she's a drug dealer, and she has this plot where all the drugs she's put out in the world, she has created this virus strain that, I'm spoiling a little bit of the movie here, but whatever, it's been out for a weekend, and you're not going to see it. So.
No,
but anyway,
I haven't seen the first one.
Yeah, so the whole idea is that she's going to blackmail, like, the world, where she's going to make the world decriminalize drugs, so she will send the antidote out to this poison she's put in her drugs. And it raises these issues, and the film consciously raises these issues of, like, you know, that recreational drug use we shouldn't view as such a villainizing thing as we do. And that's a very complex, loaded topic. Uh-huh. It also has racial implications the movie does not get into in the fucking slightest. And all these things. And, like, there's,
like,
this
economic
whole...
economic implications, yes, yeah.
There's this whole subplot where the president of the United States just wants to let them all die because they're junkies and he can get rid of them all in one fell swoop. Which is also something, like, I actually think you could take that a step further and have... do something interesting with that. Yeah. But you have to really go for it. And all of that, like, the movie... Kingsman at its best, at the platonic ideal of Kingsman, it is too silly a movie series to deal with a theme that complex, and it just shouldn't be broached, and I thought that was the grossest part of the movie.
Okay.
So, problematic. Overall, again, if you liked the first one, this one's worth going to see. It's got some fun stuff in it. There's some good action. And again, Mark Strong makes the movie in at least one great scene. But yeah, I wonder if there's really enough gas in this tank to do a series of Kingsman movies, like if they want to do a third one. Mm-hmm. You know, if we want to go to another James Bond knockoff, although this one is much more kid-friendly, this is from my youth that I'm remembering, this is not dissimilar to the Agent Cody Banks series.
Okay, which was, okay. Of all the things you're going to say, that was the last thing I would have ever thought of.
Whereas a kid, the first one was pretty cool. You know, Frankie Muniz gets with Hilary Duff, and that's cool. But then the second one, like, he goes to London.
Was that an actual theatrical release, or yes. was it not a Disney original movie?
No. Those are both theatrical releases by MGM, I believe. But anyway, and then the second movie was, like, really kind of lame and disappointing. And I'm sure if I watched them now, they'd both be lame and disappointing.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. But it speaks to... That's just one analog, because there's a bunch of the James Bond knockoffs.
Yeah.
You can frequently make the fun James Bond knockoff for movie one, and if you try to do a sequel, it falls apart. And I think Kingsman might have fallen into that. It's like one of the reasons why Galaxy Quest is so beloved as a Star Trek knockoff
right.
is they never made Galaxy Quest 2.
Yeah, because it's like...
You know what I mean?
Yeah, because there's usually not enough material to do it twice, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Unless you're going like super deep with your references. Yeah. Yeah.
Now, instead of Agent Cody Banks, you know, I could have referenced the Alex Rider books by Anthony Horowitz, but the books are actually pretty fun, and they only made one movie and it bombed, so they never got to the sequel stage. So anyway, James Bond knockoffs are one of my favorite sub-weird sub-genres, so this is why I can go deep with them.
I have also just Wikipedia'd Frankie Muniz, because when you said Frankie Muniz, I was like...
He's a NASCAR driver now.
Yeah! In 2000... So here's... I'm just going to read to you the second paragraph of his Wikipedia article. In 2003, he was considered one of Hollywood's most bankable teens, in quotations. In 2008, he put his acting career on hold to pursue an open-wheel racing career. He competed in the Atlantic Championship... So that's already crazy. And his picture on Wikipedia is him in his, like, racing outfit. The best part is this last sentence. In 2012, he joined the band Kingsfoil as a drummer. He left the band in 2014. So if you...
Hey, when I was a
Frankie
kid...
Frankie Muniz watched, that's where he's at.
When I was a kid, I loved Frankie Muniz. Big Fat Liar, fun movie. He was in Malcolm in the Middle. Good show.
Sure. I will give you Malcolm in the Middle. Like, all the other ones are movies, like Agent Cody Banks and Big Fat Liar are the two movies I can very specifically remember being, like, seeing at a sleepover at someone's house and feeling like, why are we watching this movie? Like, that's the sleepover at the friend's house that you're like, I'm not friends enough with you usually to, like, this is a bad idea. Like, we're not close enough friends to do this. Like, when I slept over at this other kid's house, we watched The Matrix. When I was slept over at this other kid's house, we watched Princess Mononoke. With you, I watched fucking Agent Cody Banks. This friendship's going nowhere. We need to cut this off right now. That's what the Frankie Muniz movie is.
Let me make here's another James Bond knockoff reference I can do. Because I think Kingsman, it's a tradition. Johnny English, the movie with Rowan Atkinson.
Okay.
Johnny English 1 is a fun parody kind of thing. Johnny English 2, which came
out
10 years. They did. It came out 10 years later. It's called Johnny English Reborn. We watched half an hour of it in the theater, and I walked out because it was really bad. And there were people behind us talking, and we just couldn't stand it. So, anyway, Kingsman, I think, falls in that tradition of you get your one spy movie knockoff thing, and it's fun. Don't make a sequel.
Would you count Spy Kids in there? Does Spy Kids, or is that, like, a bit too far afield?
Spy Kids is too far afield because Robert Rodriguez is a crazy person,
yeah.
And it's not really... I mean, Spy Kids 1 is about, like, an evil toy maker, right? Like,
I think so. With,
like, yeah. Alan Cummings is the villain. It's so different that I don't think
there's
you can
like
really
dinosaurs
consider it.
And shit, yeah.
Yeah, there was another series in the back of my head I was thinking about that has maybe made it work longer term. Yeah, Spy Kids, close enough, but the sequels to Spy Kids were okay. Like, if you liked the first one, 2 was okay.
Spy Kids 1 was a decent kids movie.
It's a very decent
behind
kids
that.
Movie.
Like, a lot better than Agent Cody Banks.
Yeah, Spy Kids 2 has some fun stuff. I mean, they all have Danny Trejo and Antonio Banderas. Yeah. That's fucking awesome.
Spy Kids 3 has Elijah Wood in it for one scene.
It does. It has Sylvester Stallone as the villain.
It does.
And,
right,
he learns the power of love.
Uh-huh.
I like, you know, they're good kids movies.
You gotta get the 3D glasses, though.
Yeah, there's a scene in that movie where I love how shamelessly Spy Kids 3D used 3D, where there's a scene where Antonio Banderas, he gets a call that, like, his kids need him, and he's working in a lab with, like, he's getting the cure to cancer, and so he just goes, my kids need me. So he takes off his glasses and swings them and breaks all of his chemistry equipment so that the glass can fly at the audience. No explanation why he did that. It's just that Antonio Banderas looked cool doing that in 3D, and I get it.
Yeah. I think we're identifying, though, then where the Kingsman series needs to go for the third movie.
Antonio Banderas
and, like, 3D, but, like, good 3D. And by good 3D, I don't mean that atmospheric bullshit we got since Avatar. I mean, fucking just throw shit into the camera, but it's like, you know, a rated R movie, so it can be, you know, penises or something. I don't know.
When I said this podcast was going to be loose, I meant it.
Where, yeah, I mean, this is where it's just shooting the shit. Like you said, we're unscripted because we usually write scripts for these if people didn't know. yeah, and there's no main topic to anchor any of this.
No. All right, let's move on to some news and stuff. Okay. All right.
You don't want to talk about Agent Cody Banks for another hour?
No, I can make the deep cuts. Look, there's a lot.
You totally can.
Yeah. All right. Here's a movie that might be good, might be not. We got a trailer this week for the new Tomb Raider movie. Starring Academy Award winner Alicia Vikander.
Yeah.
I think that's the first time a video game movie has gotten to advertise in the trailer with Academy Award winner.
Starring, yeah.
I mean, you would with Michael Fassbender if the Academy Awards ever recognized him for Assassin's Creed, but sadly they haven't yet. So, no go for poor Michael Fassbender. But Alicia Vikander is the new Tomb Raider. She is Lara Croft.
Yeah.
And I watched this trailer, and I'm not going to say like it looks like a great movie.
Yeah.
It looks like a decent movie. It looks like a movie I'd go pay $10 to see. And I know that's a low bar, but for video game movies, it cleared that bar.
Yeah, like, the thing I found most interesting about the trailer was that it looked like a pretty close adaptation of the new Tomb Raider games.
The Crystal Dynamics ones,
yeah. Particularly, like, they were, like, basically quoting specific action scenes from that first game with, like, the rusted old plane and stuff like that.
Yeah, and you have, I mean, she has, like, the hatchet thing she uses to climb with from those games. They mention Trinity, which is the evil organization from the new games. The stuff with her dad feels very pulled from, particularly, Rise of the Tomb Raider. Have you played that yet?
No, I keep on meaning to get around to it, but 500 video games keep on coming out.
It's really good. Sadly, that's what happened to it for a lot of people.
Yeah.
But it's a great game. No, it looked like, Alicia Vikander looks like kind of perfect casting for this version of Lara Croft, which is great. You know, you've got Dominic West as her father, which is really cool. Walton Goggins is the bad guy. Nick Frost is in one scene.
Yeah, in the scene that's, like, clearly the last scene in the movie, like, that scene where she has the two pistols, and it's like, this is the last, this might even be the scene at the end of the credits. This is so the last scene of this movie. I can't believe you put this in the trailers. I mean, it's fine, because it's not, like, giving the plot away, but it was so, like, there's no way this is anywhere else in that movie because it's like her getting her pistols and like the whole Tomb Raider outfit.
Yeah.
That's the end of that movie.
But I wanted to mention this trailer because, again, I don't know if this is going to be a great movie or anything, but most of the time when I watch a trailer for a video game movie, any video game movie, it feels hollow and soulless and pandering.
Yeah.
And then you actually see the movie and it's somehow even worse than that, which is from all accounts what the Assassin's Creed movie was, for instance.
Yeah.
This movie actually, like, as a big fan of the two recent Crystal Dynamics games, this looked kind of like if I read a book that I love and then I see a trailer and it's like It. If you saw the trailer for It and you loved the book and you're like, that seems like they got it. That's what I got out of this trailer. It's like, that looks like the Lara Croft I know and love. I like the setup here. She's going around and exploring and there's big crazy action and she's doing climbing and archaeology and all this cool shit. And it's like, yeah, that's what I like. It looks like a good cinematic representation of that. Alicia Vikander seems like perfect casting. It's got a good supporting cast. Like, this feels like a movie that, at least from this 2-minute trailer, was made by people who played and enjoyed those video games. And again, I know that's a low bar, but it's a bar that seemingly has never been cleared.
Right.
In live-action Hollywood video game adaptations.
Yes, so you have to put the Persona 3 animated movies to the side. Yes. Because those are still, whenever I'm hearing people on like a podcast or something talking about how there's no good video game movies, and my other, like, there are exactly 4, and they are very good.
No,
they're very hard to see.
That's
but
what
one of them is on Netflix, and it is not the first one. And it is still there. I checked just the other day.
How is that? Things leave Netflix every day. How is that still there?
Persona 3, the movie, number 2, Midsummer Night's Dream, is still on there as of yesterday when I was checking if they had all the episodes of Little Witch Academia up there, and they do now.
Okay, wonderful. Can't wait for our Little Witch Academia podcast.
It's a very good show.
Okay. No, but what the fuck were we talking about?
Tomb Raider.
Well, I know we were talking about Tomb Raider. I forget what point I was making.
Video game movies.
Yeah. That's why I always qualify it with Hollywood video game movies, because Persona, very much not Hollywood. But yes, so I don't know. Like, this went from being something where I was like, I'll wait and who knows, to I watched that trailer, I'm like, sure, I'll go see it.
Yeah.
Doesn't mean I'll love it, but I'll go see it.
Yeah, it has piqued my interest enough, particularly in that, like, I just found it really interesting because it did not occur to me that video game movies almost never sort of, like, directly visually quote what they're, like, adapting.
Yeah.
In a way that, like, it's just weird because video games are a visual medium at their core. Like, you have to see them to interface with them. And so it's weird that video game movies, like, the closest they get is, like, when Doom the movie has the first-person sequence or whatever. Like, that's the closest you get is, like, kind of approximating the visual imagery of the thing. Whereas, like, this is, again, it's, like, directly, like, referencing her, like, the way she jumps off the ship into the water in the trailer. And the way she jumps onto that plane and the plane starts to sink. Like, those are all, like, directly you could look at, like, those action sequences from the video game and look at where they shot that in the trailer. And if you, like, rotated the camera in the right way in the video game, you could basically replicate that shot.
You know, and Alicia Vikander has pretty much the exact costume that Lara has in the first of the reboot games. So just things like that. It's also kind of interesting to, you know, Tomb Raider back in, like, the year 2000 was, like, the only big video game movie for years. The Angelina Jolie one. And, you know, that movie feels like such a relic, but also early Tomb Raider games feel like such a relic.
Yeah.
Because it's all this, you know, very obviously overt sexualization of Lara and all these issues. And it's nice that, like, this does feel like part of why the new games are such good source material is they found a way to modernize Lara for the video game landscape and make her feel like a good character and not masturbation material for teenage boys. And it's like, okay, and the movie found a way to do that too. This doesn't feel like a retread of what we've already done with, you know, the Angelina Jolie movies. Which I think most people have forgotten about, except as, like, pop culture relics.
Yeah, I always forget that those movies ever existed. It's the same thing if I always forget that...
There were
that, two. I always forget that they made Tomb Raider movies, and I always forget that they're, like, the Resident Evil movies are technically... Those are technically video game movies.
They have nothing to do with the games.
But they are technically video game movies. It's one of those, when you talk about video game movies, like, I think of, like, now Assassin's Creed, or, like, Doom, or Prince of Persia, like, those ones. And then it's like, oh, right, they made two Tomb Raider movies that were, like, successful enough that they kind of entered a weird part of the pop culture lexicon. And then those Resident Evil movies that they've made 500 of, and every single one they've said is the last one. In, like, the trailers, they've said they're the last one, because that's the only access of information access I have of those movies. And as far as I know, they're just going to keep on making them forever.
It's a bizarre thing.
It's a weird world, video game movies. But again, there are four good ones.
Yes, there are four good ones. We reviewed all of them on the podcast. If you subscribe to our YouTube channel, I have a playlist where you can just find all our Persona 3 chats in one playlist.
There we go.
And I even have a mega playlist for all of our Persona chats, period. And it's really long.
I assume it would be.
Yeah. Anyway, all right, let's move on. So our next two pieces of news are sort of discussions. One is fun, and that will be our reward for getting through the one that is hard.
Okay.
Okay? The one that is hard, on my outline, it just says racism on YouTube and sexism in movies. This is a reference to a trend that obviously is not new. YouTube has always been racist, and movies have always been sexist. But it has
and,
come...
And vice versa.
Vice versa, yes. And it has come to a boil lately, though, because PewDiePie proved once again that he is a flaming racist on the internet and a horrible person, but we still give him things, and I don't know why. So that happened. And to me, like, I didn't bring that up on the podcast because it's, like, so self-evident. I didn't quite know what to add to it, but I think the more you see the cultural context... I mean, we're recording this on the day that players in the NFL all took a knee because Donald Trump was an asshole and wanted to silence Colin Kaepernick and instead made everyone in the league imitate him. And things like that. So, you know, this is all part of an ongoing cultural conversation. And, of course, the sexism movies thing is also important. All of this to me also, like, the Donald Trump thing you can't ignore, that we have a racist and sexual predator in the White House. And so they're all coming out of the fucking woodwork. But, you know, the thing with movies right now, if you have not been, it's been blowing up film Twitter and film websites and stuff that, to recap, I'll try to do this as cleanly as I can. It's hard.
Because I feel like there's the thing that happened very recently, and there was another thing that's slightly more recent.
So I believe it was late last year or early this year. There was a writer for the Alamo Drafthouse for their like online writing division. They have a little magazine and stuff called Birth, Movies, Death. His name is Devin Faraci. He'd been on the scene forever. It was a pretty open secret that Devin Faraci was an asshole and he was combative online and he was probably not good in his relations with women. And then it came out much more explicitly because he kind of crossed the line and women just started accusing him online much more openly than they had before. And he copped to it and resigned. That he had sexually harassed a lot of women online in chat and things like that, and in person, I believe, as well. At events and whatnot. So he apparently left the Draft House and Birth, Movies, Death. Tim League, the head of the Alamo Draft House, and by extension also the head of Fantastic Fest. These are all going to become important. And one of the major figures in the Austin film scene, where a lot of this comes from, kind of confirmed Devin was gone and said they were going to try to make amends for this. Well, it came out last week through a Hollywood Reporter, or well, like 2 weeks ago, it's been an ongoing thing, through a Hollywood Reporter article and then some more stuff, that Devin Faraci had in fact not left Birth Movies Death. He had continued to be on the payroll. I guess he had left Birth Movies Death. He was still doing copywriting for the Draft House and for Fantastic Fest, and this had been kept a secret, but it was again an open secret among employees at the Draft House, because the Draft House is a wide nationwide chain now, a lot of employees, and they would see him like CC'd on emails and stuff. And Tim League had been keeping it a secret, basically, that he had kept this guy on the payroll on the down low. It came out, Devin Faraci left again, Tim League made an apology again, but all of this rang understandably hollow, because you lied about keeping a sexual predator, or sexual harasser at least, employed, and that's a really shitty thing to do.
Yeah.
Now, on top of this, this had a big impact on Fantastic Fest, which is the Austin film festival hosted by Tim League and the Alamo Drafthouse. People were pulling out of Fantastic Fest. You also had one of the main organizers, programmers at Fantastic Fest. He resigned as soon as he heard about this because he was outraged. He did not know Faraci was working for it, and he did not feel comfortable working there anymore. And then we also started hearing rumblings that Ain't It Cool News, which is run by a guy named Harry Knowles, one of the oldest film blogs on the internet. You have probably heard of them before at some point if you followed film on the internet. Also based in Austin, Harry Knowles was a co-sponsor of Fantastic Fest. They had pulled out of Fantastic Fest for reasons we couldn't quite understand. And then, I don't even know who published this last piece, I think it was Variety, had a revelation that Harry, or maybe it was, no, it was Vulture, I think. I don't remember. Someone of the sites.
Yeah.
Had a revelation that Harry Knowles had also sexually harassed women in person, like groping and things like that. And someone had basically talked to this journalist to try to get that story out there. And then more stuff again. As soon as you get one accusation, obviously more come out because people feel more emboldened, and they should, to tell their stories and let people know who these people are. And it seems Harry Knowles has a pattern of doing this over the last 20 years. And Tim League is all buddy-buddy with this guy, too. What it speaks to, there's many, many things to get into here, obviously.
Yeah.
What it speaks to, obviously, is a very toxic misogynist culture and sexist culture in film and in film coverage specifically, because this is not talking about filmmaking or Hollywood. This is talking about film coverage and distribution, with Tim League being a very influential figure in both. In the Alamo Drafthouse, you know, Harry Knowles being a very influential figure in the online film writing community, and how much women are erased and mistreated in all of this. And it is sad and disgusting, and I think people are, you know, working out their feelings on this in different ways. Some people saying they want to boycott the Drafthouse, some people saying Fantastic Fest should be shut down. You know, I have thoughts on all these things. I think all of these reactions and more are valid. You know, I think some of these people have been doing really despicable things. It is also absolutely true what has been said, that you can't just take Devin Faraci, Harry Knowles, and Tim League and kick them out and say we're okay now. There's a culture around this that is really toxic, and that's why I think I draw the line in my head to the racism on YouTube thing, because this specific incident was all about PewDiePie, but the fact that he feels emboldened to say the N-word in a stream speaks to something in gaming culture that is much more corrosive, and all of this is part of what's going on in the world right now, and it has many wide-ranging implications. And I think I wanted to talk about it because I got to a point where I had tweeted about this a couple times, but this is not something I can easily sum up in 140 characters.
Right.
Because the basics of it, obviously, PewDiePie, despicable. What Tim League and Faraci and Harry Knowles did, despicable, awful, shouldn't have their jobs, those things. But there's below beneath the surface, you know, because there's a million things that come from that. And that's what I wanted to dive in here. And again, if we get through this discussion, we get to talk about something silly.
Yeah. So before we move on to sort of like really getting into it now, I think let me take like the PewDiePie of the video game side of it. Because there's also like a basically this whole year long spanning thing with that as well.
Did I do an okay job summarizing?
Yes, I think that is all, from what I remember, that's all accurate with the Faraci stuff and then the Harry Knowles stuff. So this, like you, it's mostly this year with this YouTube stuff, but PewDiePie has had criticism about him for a long time. If you don't know who PewDiePie is, he's basically the biggest YouTube Let's Player, the biggest YouTuber by extension from that, on YouTube, like millions and millions of, like 13 million or something fucking ridiculous subscribers, hugely influential in that scene. He's like a bit, he's basically our age So he's like in his mid-20s, which means he's a bit weirdly like a bit too young for us, like when we were into like internet culture, because you watch someone who's a little bit older than you typically. So like we were watching like Red versus Blue Rooster Teeth kind of stuff when he was like kind of coming up in Let's Plays.
Yeah, I've never watched a PewDiePie video.
Me neither.
In completion. I've seen clips when he says the N-word or something.
Yeah, so it's like it's something that I'm not sort of, while I do like Let's Plays and I watch Let's Plays, not like that's like younger than me in a weird way, and so I've never really engaged with that stuff, and I've never seen his videos. But he's faced criticism for years now for, like, usually it's sort of like rape humor of, like, by rape humor I mean he plays horror games and screams, "Oh, I'm getting raped!" while a monster attacks him, is basically the substance of the joke. He's a great comedian, like, just a great crafter of comedy and humor and jokes. It's really well done.
Sarcasm, if you can't tell.
Yeah, but he's faced criticism about that stuff for a long time. And then earlier this year, I believe it was the Washington Post put out a story that sort of like basically talked about how there's a lot of like weirdly prevalent anti-Semitic and like Nazi-based humor in some of his videos.
That might have been the Wall Street Journal.
Yeah, the Wall Street Journal. That's right. You're right.
Because he had like a public campaign against them.
So there were a couple of videos where he was like basically dressed up as Hitler and did this stuff. I think the biggest one that was like the sticking point is a video, I forget all the specific details of this, but basically he used some sort of like Kickstarter-esque online service to pay some people, I think that were living in like India, to hold up a sign that said "Death to all Jews," that these people in India, I believe, like didn't even speak English, so they didn't know anything of what that sign was, but he basically like paid them $5 to do that and then made a video and like laughed at it. And that was when it was like, there's no joke there. There's no, or like the joke you're making is like how funny it is that you can pay someone in a third world country to hold up a sign that has an anti-Semitic joke on it. Like that's, if you're like even cutting this,
it's not a joke though. It's just an anti-Semitic sentiment.
Sentiment. Thank you. Like on it. Like there's nowhere you slice that scene and that like video. Nowhere is it good. It's bad all the way down. Right. And so then the Wall Street Journal sort of broke that story, which meant that Disney, that had a very short-lived partnership with PewDiePie, they had a video with Disney.
Through Maker.
Yeah, through Maker. Disney was like, fuck this shit, which was a opening salvo in what has been a year-long thing of advertisers basically pulling out of YouTube for a whole number of different reasons.
Because he's not the only one.
Yes, he's not
the only one. We learned about a lot of people with anti-immigrant and other sentiments.
Yes, yeah. So that happened, then, as you were saying earlier, PewDiePie then basically waged a weird campaign against the Wall Street Journal with a series of videos, like creating, for me, like I feel like fabricating this kind of culture war between print media and online media that just speaks to the insecurity of PewDiePie to me of like, I don't think print media gives that much of a shit. I think they were just breaking the story because it's a legitimate story.
Also, print media, it's the Wall Street Journal. They're fine.
Yeah, like, I don't think, like, I feel like they're secure enough in the position. They're not afraid of PewDiePie. Like, that's, you know, you can disagree with that reading of it, but that's very much how I feel.
The Wall Street Journal is a fucking conservative publication.
Yeah.
And they're calling out your racism. Maybe you're on the wrong side.
Yeah. So PewDiePie made a lot of, like, weird videos and just perpetuated this weird culture war after that. Then I think the other big one was JonTron, who is another big YouTuber that, again, I haven't seen any of his videos. Like, and, like, JonTron is actually, he's not as big as PewDiePie, but his stuff is, like, super fucking crazy out there. Like, it's really bad.
He's really bad, and he has quite a few different arms. Like, you know, one of the things his studio does is Did You Know Gaming.
Yeah.
Which I love. And this all, and I wanted to talk about that because this all gets to the point where we don't watch PewDiePie. But what happens when, you know, something you like is tainted by there's someone involved in it at some level, direct or indirect, who turns out to be a flaming racist or sexist or something. Yeah. And it's something worth talking about. But
yeah. You know. Also, like, along this stuff, as I'm thinking about it, a good resource for some of this stuff is Patrick Klepek's reporting on Waypoint.vice.com.
Some really good stuff there.
He's sort of followed along. Like, he has a really great article that's sort of like a more like almost like kind of like a blog post thing that's like more frank discussion about, like, I think the headline is really good. It's basically like, what do you do when your children's watching a racist on YouTube? It's basically the headline. It's some good stuff there.
Yeah.
So then JonTron, like, his is all like this like really extreme like alt-right, far right-wing rhetoric about like anti-immigration stuff. Like, as bad as fucking PewDiePie is, fucking JonTron shit is nuts.
Well, because, okay, here's the difference. PewDiePie is just an idiot who uses racism for humor, which is awful.
Right, it's JonTron has this, like, direct, like,
ideology.
Intense ideology, like, behind all of that that is very clear, and he is not afraid to sort of like bring that ideology out. That's one of the many things about Donald Trump and the alt-right movement is it's become so apparent and so mainstream that it allows someone like John Tron to feel empowered to sort of like just go crazy in a way that like normally they would hide that shit. It's, you know, you see that with like the riots in Charlottesville and all that stuff. So then now like bringing that up to where we are right now, like a week or so ago, about 2 weeks ago, PewDiePie had a video where he was playing, it was like a live stream he was doing on Twitch, where he was playing PlayerUnknown's Battlegrounds, the like online multiplayer shooter of the day.
And so much PlayerUnknown's Battlegrounds news lately that really makes me want to play that wonderful game.
Yeah, like whatever. Let's
talk about that.
Yeah, but so PUBG, which is like how it's referred to, because it's much easier to say. He was playing PUBG and like trying to shoot some guy on a bridge, and he couldn't shoot him very well. And so then he basically just said, "Oh, that fucking N-word." But he didn't say the N-word. He didn't say, quote, the N-word. He said actually that word in a way that was really like, oh man, that's really bad. And immediately after he says it, he's like, "Oh, that fucking asshole." And then but he does it, and you can tell that he realized, I really shouldn't have said that on a fucking live stream where I can't edit that out. But he didn't apologize for it immediately. He didn't backpedal for it at all. And it wasn't until like 2 or 3 days later, after like this really blew up, that he put out an apology video. This is like the fifth fucking apology video he's had to put out this year. That's just like, if you were very sincere about this apology, you would have made it in that live stream, dude. Because it's like he live streamed for like an hour or something after he made that comment.
Yeah, you would stop playing.
Yeah.
You would probably shut down the stream and figure out something to do.
And then also, like, I mean, in live streams since then, he has basically made similar comments and used similar language, kind of playing, like, jokes off of the fact that he did that in the first place, that then has not become more widely publicized in the way that really makes his apology feel. It already felt disingenuous because of his history. It then, like, makes it, like, feel especially disingenuous because he has... It does not feel like he has sort of considered that at all.
So focusing on the behavior at all. Focusing on the PewDiePie thing for a second.
Yes.
Sean, you and I, look, we all have, we can admit it, we've all said things we regret on the internet.
Yes. Yeah. I was 13 years old once.
Yes.
I'm a 25 or 24, yeah, almost 25-year-old adult man now.
Yeah. We've been playing games all our lives. We've been playing online much of our lives. We've said things we regret. Sean, at any point in your life, have you called someone the N-word online?
No. No, yeah, no, that's never, that hasn't, as he said, that's never slipped out from me, which I think is the language he used.
Let alone,
slipped out.
And here's the thing, if PewDiePie was a 15-year-old kid or something and said that, still be awful.
Yeah.
Still be unacceptable.
It would be understandable.
Because you would, yeah, you can see someone who is inundated with this shit and is being an idiot and they're growing up and it's like, okay, you should know better, but hopefully this is a learning experience. Still unacceptable.
Yeah.
When you're an adult who makes millions of fucking dollars and has a responsibility as a creator, it's not just unacceptable, it's disqualifying from your profession.
I mean, yeah, it's the kind of thing that if, like, Stephen Colbert did that on his show, like, he would be fired immediately. Like, he would be fired before that fucking show finished airing.
Stephen Colbert, Bill Maher did it, and no consequences. Bill Maher did that. I mean, he didn't call someone the N-word, but he used it in a joke.
Right, yeah.
Stephen Colbert would resign because he's a good person and has scruples. That's the thing, though. I don't know if there are consequences anymore.
That's a fair point.
And that's what pisses me off, because that's actually also worth roping into this, is that Bill Maher just fucking said the N-word on HBO. Not in, like, the sense of, like, if someone says it on The Wire.
Right.
No, in his fucking talk show. And so that's the thing, yeah. But yeah, no, you're right. In general, most media companies would have higher standards for that.
I mean, because also HBO is a slightly different thing than like CBS, right?
Yeah, yeah.
That like that if you were, but like what PewDiePie is he's like, he's the CBS of YouTube, right?
Yes.
Like he's the most mainstream ass YouTuber there is. He is like over 10 million subscribers. Like that's a huge audience that watches him, that, like, pays attention to what he does. Again, most of them are younger. Most of them are teenagers. It's like he has a very direct responsibility. And it's not, like, he's not a teenager. It's the kind of thing, if I think back when, like, you know, I was, like, 13 or 14 years old. Like, one, never use the N-word.
No.
Because that's, like, so taboo. But like, I definitely used language that I would in no way use now. Like, I use the F word that's like a homosexual slur sometimes, like the R word, you know, that's an ableist term. Like that language, when I was, again, like 13 or 14, I used it because I didn't really understand the larger context in which that language existed sometimes.
And if we have younger listeners who think that's horrifying, that also, culture changes fast. That sure. was more of a thing.
It was more of a thing, but we were also, but only also, for like 13-year-olds. Yes, like only not for 13, for, yes. Like that language was bad then, yeah. But like.
And I think one of your things you're saying though is that for no age group now, is that an okay thing?
Yeah.
You know?
But yeah, but it's, but like regardless, like, you know, fucking 13-year-olds are going to do dumb shit. Like if a 13-year-old says that online, you have to like have perspective on how young they are. And like, that's like, I would understand that and I like, you know, but come to terms with like, you know, stuff that you do when you're younger because you grow out of it. It's like PewDiePie's not a kid. He doesn't, there's no excuse. There's no like that slipped out because that doesn't just slip out. Like language, here, let's get into language theory, linguistics and semiotics for a second. Language very literally and realistically and actually constructs and informs the way you think. Like you think through language. Like different linguistic terms modify your ability to think about things. Like how you think informs how you speak. And that is just like cognitive fact. And so when you let something slip out, quote unquote, the way he said it, it's like that doesn't mean that that didn't mean anything. That actually means that that's what you were thinking in that moment. Like that's part of like that has informed your actual self and you were expressing your actual self. Like, the N-word is a term that has so much loaded, historical, incredibly deep-seated racial hatred baggage associated with it, particularly in the way that he was using that word, that's like,
you know, it's a white guy.
Yeah, like, talking about how it's used in, like, African-American vernacular English, that's a totally different discussion. How he was using that word was 100% how that word was used in, you know, like, the villain would use it in a Quentin Tarantino movie, right? Like, it's that kind of shit.
Like Quentin Tarantino would use it in a Quentin Tarantino
sure,
movie.
Yeah. It's the kind of, like, you know, the way he was using it was the way that is informed by all that hate and racial bias with it, or else he wouldn't have used it in this, like, expression of anger towards this, like, other player in the video game. You know, he would have, if it wasn't associated with all that stuff, he would have never chosen to use that word in the first place. So him using that word like that just gives us access to, like, oh, yeah, no, like, you're a racist. Like, you are. Like, straight up, you would not use that word unless that was informed by some sort of, like, ideology or something that is behind that. Like, there has to be something there, and it is a specific racial term. You're not just using that randomly. You don't just grab words out of a fucking box, you know? It is something that you can't just excuse it and laugh it away. The way he used that word in that moment where he was not aware of, like, the platform he was on tells you that he uses that word in his private time constantly. Like, he must.
And this is where the intersection for me with the other conversation about sexism in the film scene comes in, because it's about this toxicity that people at the top allow to perpetuate or perpetuate themselves that creates a culture.
Yeah.
Because PewDiePie saying, let's say PewDiePie, I don't remember, is it Felix Kjellberg or something?
Yeah.
Let's say Felix Kjellberg never got famous on the internet. And he's just a guy sitting in his home playing a video game, and he says the N-word like that. That's still awful. And he shouldn't do that. He's an adult. It's a terrible thing to do. There's a difference when he is PewDiePie, the most popular YouTuber. He is watched by tens of millions. Many of them are kids. Yeah. And he informs a generation of young white male gamers.
Yeah.
And he, by doing that, by doing the other shit he does, and, you know, this is one blip on the radar that is particularly horrible, but there's a lot of blips of him saying, of all the rape culture jokes and the misogyny and all this stuff that we don't take seriously enough either, because all of it should be worth the outrage. And what that does is that perpetuates this thing that should be going away, which is kids online talking like utter assholes.
Yeah.
Kids are always going to do dumb things. You can help mitigate it by being a good role model.
Yeah.
You know? Like, you know, for instance, we talked about, we came up watching like the Rooster Teeth stuff.
Yeah.
I don't watch a ton of the Rooster Teeth stuff anymore, but they have a big Let's Play network and they have lots of good stuff. And they don't go around saying the N-word, you know?
No. Yeah.
In fact, I would say they can be outrageous and have fun. They're pretty responsible in terms of representation and who they have on and you know, showing kids a role model of how to have fun with games without being a racist asshole. You can do it. There are more Let's Players who do a good job at this than bad.
Yeah.
You know? That's just a thing. But Felix, you know, this guy PewDiePie is at the top, and so that feeds into everything. You know, I am known to shit on the website Polygon on this podcast.
Yeah.
But they did have an article this week that I liked and I want to call out because I want to be nice when I can. That was "Gamers Like PewDiePie Are Why I Don't Play Online" by Mike Shoulders, is his name. And
he's a guest writer.
Yeah, and you know, I look at an article like that, particularly that headline just caught my attention because yes, that's a great way to phrase it, you know? That's the kind of thing that keeps people feeling like they are not accepted online, that they don't want to have fun in these online spaces that should be inclusive and a good community. And a guy like PewDiePie going around and doing this shit and being this horrible role model to kids and young adults and perpetuating this kind of culture is awful and shines poorly on everyone else.
Yeah.
On absolutely everyone else. So, you know, there are many more things we could get into about the business side of this, like the adpocalypse that's happening on YouTube. And on one level, you know, that's a horrible thing for all the creators doing good work. And I feel very bad for them. I also understand the position of the advertisers, because once you realize, oh shit, there's this racist well within all this, and we don't want to be associated with that, that's their right. They don't want to be associated with that.
Yeah.
But, you know, Felix, you know, PewDiePie doesn't just have a responsibility to himself, he has a responsibility to the community not to shine this negative light on it, because when you start doing that, it's a community issue, it's not just him. And that doesn't mean other people who do good work are responsible for it, but they also have to bear the burden.
Yeah.
And it sucks for everyone.
And it's just that kind of thing of that if you are, like, making those kinds of jokes and using that kind of language for that, like, younger audience, you are normalizing those concepts and that language to them. That is then, again, that's just perpetuating the problem and extending it further and further when it's like, we should be getting better at this, not worse. And it's like, and it's one of those things that it does, like, push people like us away, or the person who wrote that article on Polygon, and pushes us out of those kinds of communities that then just help those communities be, like, walled off and shelled off and allow that kind of behavior to fester.
You know,
to where, like, you know, it takes a really big slip-up on the part of PewDiePie where he just straight-up says the N-word like that, like, for anybody to notice, when he's been making those kinds of jokes and using that kind of language constantly for years.
Yeah.
Just, like, not as explicitly.
And, you know, so much of and realizing that this is not just not solved, but in some ways getting worse, makes me so sad because, as I said, we've been gaming since online console gaming started to be a thing.
Yeah.
And I've largely been scared off going online in chat because it's just not something I like to do. And that's not, you know, I'm a white, straight guy.
Yeah.
It's not because I get, like, harassed all the time. It's because I find it annoying and toxic and gross. And I'm not the target. If you're the target of that, it's even worse.
Yeah.
Much worse. More than, you know, I think we can, like, fathom. And so I've been put off that, and I'm probably never going to get back into that. Like, I realized, playing Destiny 2 this week, there's a guided games thing they have now that's cool. And in the couple of experiences I've had in Destiny where I do get in a group and do a raid or something, it's been generally a positive experience. But I still have this, like, social anxiety where I just don't like to get online and talk to random people in a video game.
Yeah.
And I want to live in a world where, you know, kids coming up through the community now don't have to feel that way. And they can hopefully have more positive experiences. And I do think there are areas where people can have more positive experiences. There's lots of cool, you know, Let's Players making cool communities.
Yeah.
And games that I think embrace a certain positivity, like Minecraft or something, when you play together. And that's great. And I do think in some ways it is better than when we were kids. But then you look at PewDiePie, and I think the culture he promotes and is part of all of this that is perpetuated by him and is perpetuated, you know, within him.
And made in, like, sort of couched in a larger culture that's where this stuff has sort of, like, bubbled up and been much more apparent over the past couple of years. And it's not hiding away in the shadows it was when we were kids.
Right. And it's just a reminder, like, no, people still have to deal with this shit, and that sucks.
Yeah. Yeah, the other part of the PewDiePie thing I want to bring up really quickly, because you talking about the apocalypse reminded me of it, is because it caused a bit of a stir that I found interesting, because I kind of disagreed with a lot of the main grain of the conversation, was that Campo Santo, which is the developer that made the game Firewatch that came out, I think, last year, maybe 2 years ago, after all the PewDiePie stuff came out, they basically went on Twitter and said, we are immediately we are DMCAing our his Firewatch Let's Play of our game, and we are like taking that down immediately because of this, because we're not just going to like sit idly by and let our content be associated with that. And the main
100% within their right.
Yeah, and I basically agree with what they did, but the main sort of like conversation I found in a lot of the video game community was like, ooh, like that's a step too far. And I found like a lot of like people talking about, what I found just kind of weirdly hilarious was people talking about like this slippery slope argument of like, well, if we let them DMCA this video, then like all these other people, like then it, like then what like grounds do we have to stand on if we're like in this sort of larger like copyright argument on YouTube? And the thing that drove me fucking insane about that is like, you idiots, you can't make a slippery slope argument when we're already at the bottom of the hill. We're in the gutter. Like, yeah. We're not standing on the top of this, like, precarious hill being like, if one thing shifts, then it all breaks down. Like, the copyright stuff on YouTube has been broken since YouTube started. Like, you could, like, I could fucking take a random video, like, video down on YouTube by filing a DMCA claim that I have no right to at all. And YouTube would just respond to it and see to that immediately and take it down. You see, that happens all the fucking time. People who, like, you know, made music for a video game and like specifically allowed like license that developers like you can use this in your trailer. I am the person who made this music. Some other random company that has no right to that will to get that video taken down because the algorithm fucked up or whatever.
Yeah, we actually have that on Mario Part 3. It's not out to the public yet. It has a copyright claim, so you'll see ads, which we do not run ads. And it's because a random consortium of companies claimed on the music in Mario 64. There's nothing I can do to fix that. Yeah. It's part of the video. It's part of the game.
Yeah. So the developers of the game saying we don't want this full 100% like playthrough of our like 3 to 4 hour long story-based video game that does not have a lot of replay value to like be up on his YouTube channel. Like, I think like the way, especially like the way copyright laws are right now, they 100% have the legal right and authority to do that. Like they are, I don't even think there's much gray area anymore.
Okay, let me rant on this for a second.
Okay.
Here's the thing people are saying that pisses me the fuck off, is it's like, oh, but no, it's, if you do that to one person, you have to do it to all of them because you're not, you know, applying the law equally to all of them. You're saying is, and then they're saying, you know, that the problem with that is that, oh, you're saying it's because he has different opinions than you, and even if we agree that his opinions are wrong, it's still a bad thing to do. Free speech, it's not an opinion to use the N-word.
Right.
It's not a political stance to degrade other races and sexes and people. Yeah. I don't care what Donnie fucking Trump in the White House says, that's not a political stance, that's just racism. It's like the thing of like, don't punch Nazis. You know, what if you, how would you feel if someone punched? I'm not a Nazi. I'm not advocating for people's genocide. This isn't a slippery slope. We're down in the gutter, not just on the technocrat level you're talking about. We're down in the gutter morally. And the Firewatch devs were like, we want to get out of the gutter because we don't want our game we worked hard on covered in racist mud and filth. And that's the difference. And yes, whatever option they have to use to get that off, they are well within their right to have an avowed fucking racist kicked off of their video.
Yeah.
That is A-okay in my book.
Yes.
Because you know what? Like, they shouldn't be accepted in society. That behavior just cannot be accepted. It's not an opinion. Because when you accept that behavior, you minimalize and erase other people and take away their rights. And their rights matter more because they are not oppressors.
Yes, exactly. I think because there are two sides to the argument that like, I think both come down for, I think for both of us, like, on the same thing of, like, there's, as you were just articulating, there's the moral side of it of, like, they are, like, yes, you're like 100% morally justified in saying like, we don't want this racist dude who's spewing racist stuff be associated with our like creative project at all. So it's like they are the moral right there. And then legally, you know, like Persona 5 came out earlier this year in the West. And when it came out, Atlus like put out this blanket statement. Like, if you play this game past this point and put videos out about it on the internet, we are like telling you right now, we will DMCA claim your videos. And it's like, there's not any sort of like legal gray area there anymore. Like, that's just the reality of Let's Play content and like that kind of stuff on the internet as it is right now, until if there's ever laws that pass that change this, You can have a different discussion then. But as it is right now, it is just this, like, you know, tacit agreement that for most companies, they recognize a mutual benefit of having, like, you know, less players make videos of their content. And then, and even more and more now, we're having, like, specifically licensed and sponsored videos where there is a legal, like, specific recognition in the less players' authority in making a video because they're being licensed and sponsored by the developer. But and other than outside of that, like, sponsored relationship, the developer holds all the power. And at any point, like, you know, the people who make the game have the right to take action against you if they just deem it necessary. And other than that, it has to just be this unspoken agreement that it's just okay because it's mutually beneficial. Like, that's the... There's no weird room where Campo Santo is somehow, I think, weighing that conversation one way or the other. They are acting within the legal authority that has already basically been established by how it's been working for years on the internet.
And we're not saying that that's right or how it ideally should be, but it is the way it is. And either way, I also think... I do want to live in a world where indie developer sees a racist playing their game, they can stop that.
Yeah.
Or playing it online for public consumption. It's different than if, you know, have the right to buy the game and play it. That's a different thing.
Yeah.
But, you know, yeah, that's, I think I, whatever system we have, fucked up or not, I think that's, oh, good that they have that option, you know?
Yeah.
Because again, it's not like, the flip side people would say is like, well, what if it was the other side and a you know, a bigot dude saw, like, a gay couple playing their game, and then they could take it down. It's like, that's different. Being gay isn't a horrible opinion.
Yeah,
it's just a lifestyle. It's just a thing you are. Being a racist is very different.
Exactly.
Being gay is not a choice. Being racist is very much a choice.
Yeah.
You know? So, look, lots of implications we could get into, but, yeah.
Yeah. So now let's, like, step out and do, like, the big level discussion to close this out.
I just fucked up. I'm sick of it. And I'm sick of... It is the thing. I'm sick of people equivocating and playing in the muck with the, you know, oh, what PewDiePie said was bad, but... And then the millions of ellipses after that, which is... It was in the heat of the moment. We all make mistakes. Or
like,
it was on...
No, we don't all do that. Like, if you're someone who's, like, made that comment online, because I saw hundreds of those, it's like, oh, I mean, it's just, he's just angry, and it slipped out in the heat of the moment. Like, that happens to everyone once in a while. It's like, no, it doesn't. It really, you need to take a look at yourself, because seriously, it does not.
Yeah.
Trust me on this.
Donald Trump has made it through hundreds of rally speeches without saying it. And you know he wants to.
Yeah.
He has better fucking impulse control than this guy.
Yeah. Like, he's like Donald Trump is a, like, obviously, like, kind of, like, as weird as it is to use this word, he's, like, a devout racist throughout, he's been for decades. You can see that in all these actions he's taken. And he is smart enough not to just fucking blurt that word out.
Yeah. Anyway, so there's that. Like, that ellipses pisses me off. The ellipses of... But the Firewatch devs, we need to leave bad reviews on Steam. But no, it's you cannot minimize these things. There's no two sides to this. And I'm not saying PewDiePie needs to go to jail and lose all of his livelihood and be outcast from society and all that. But I am saying there should be consequences for what he does. And those consequences are not... He gets to keep doing whatever he wants while we argue in our corner about the moral relativism of reacting to racism.
Right, yeah.
That's my number one thing.
Yeah, and that, like, and then you can take that to, I think, like, the great, like, the element of that is, like, great, like, from the argument perspective, is, like, that the Devin Faraci stuff, of where it came out that he was sexually harassed women, and so then... Tim League and everyone's like, okay, well, then he's leaving. Like he's not associated with us anymore. Except for he was. Except for he actually was working there for, like, an entire year, like, being paid by that company. It's like, what the fuck message does that send? Because, again, it's not... There are, like, two totally different conversations to have about, like, whether or not there should be, like, legal repercussions, which for some of that, like, the sexual harassment behavior, yes, but that's a different thing. There's also just the perspective of, like, from, like, a personal business level of, like, that company 100% has the right to fire someone if they have sexually harassed people or there are claims against them. Like, that is within their right. That is a fireable thing. Like,
and it should be because
it should be.
You want to create the culture you want to see in the world.
Yeah. And you when, like, as a company, you are not somehow chained to have to hire someone who has sexually harassed people because to, like, provide them livelihood. That's not your responsibility. It's their responsibility not to fucking harass somebody. And if they do, they have to go find another means of making a living because they're not going to be hired by that company anymore, or that's how it should work.
Something I want to talk about, the PewDiePie thing and the Devin Faraci thing, is also comes Tim Leake's first letter he wrote about this once it came out that he had lied to everyone and Devin was still on the payroll, was he talked about how he believes in giving people second chances and he believes in people rebuilding their lives and all that. And the thing is, you read that paragraph on paper and you're like, yeah, we all agree with that. We agree that, you know, or we hopefully do. It's a sad thing in America that we often don't actualize this through our justice system and all these things. But, like, you know, yeah, if you make a horrible mistake and do something wrong, I don't think that should be the end of your life. But I think if you want to reintegrate into society and you know, be public again in a as Devin Faraci was, and be working for this public facing company, you have to show an actual attempt to make amends.
Yeah,
you know, that's a key thing. So, you know, here's how this actually could have gone. If let's start with PewDiePie. If PewDiePie was actually sorry,
right,
the first thing he does is probably take some time off the internet. He comes back. He probably I think you would do your videos again, but you would change your tone a little bit. You would cut out the bullshit and show that you are trying to make a concentrated effort to change this. Maybe you have some conversations with, you know, black people in the gaming scene or women in the gaming scene or something about what you have done and what they would like to see of you to try to improve this. Do things to try to spread this conversation and not only show that what you did was wrong, but try to educate other people about that. PewDiePie is also a multimillionaire who makes tons of money off of this. He could start making donations to the ACLU or the NAACP or something like that, you know, that he could, you know, put as the Southern Poverty Law Center or something like that to try to just show that, like, you know, I am sorry, this doesn't make up for it, but here's something material I can try to give to the world. And if he's taking those steps and showing an actual attempt to better himself, then you deserve a second chance. And that's when maybe we can agree that, okay, you maybe can keep having this livelihood. That didn't happen.
Yeah.
With Devin Faraci, one, it's you stop writing for that fucking site. And, you know, in your own life, you try to put this... I don't know. It's a different thing for him because he's not a giant YouTuber or something. But you also have to show amends in some way. And part of that, for both him and for Tim Leake, who knowingly hired this guy, number one is just not being on that fucking payroll. That doesn't mean that Devin Faraci doesn't deserve to go earn a living somehow. Everyone does.
Yeah.
But, like, not in that way, not at this time.
Yeah, and there's, like, there's a difference between having this, like, public-facing job and then having a more private job. You know? Like, there's a huge difference between being a, like, big, like, writer, like, public writer, like, kind of basically, like, editor or whatever for a magazine and then an online publication, and then being someone who's, like, an accountant or whatever, like, any other sort of, like, normal job. You don't necessarily have, like, those same weird, like public-facing element to it that then defines, like, a whole part of this company to you for the world. Like, you can't just keep on working there because that sends this message, and it sends, like, the message that they're sending of that, like, there are no consequences for these actions, that it's totally fine to do this because you just have to say you're sorry and that's it. You don't have to, like, actually have some sort of material sacrifice because of the actions you've committed. And then also it's really frustrating to then think of it of that there are hundreds, thousands, millions of people who are perfectly qualified to do that job. Yep. Many of them probably, like, more qualified and would be better at it than Devin Faraci. Like, it is, like, 95% happenstance that anybody gets to the job that they're ever at. It's never 100% through merit. Like, there are lots and lots and lots and lots of people that can do that job fantastically that are not also, like, serial sexual harassers.
Yes,
and like give them the opportunity to do that fucking job.
Yeah, so if you are Tim Leake wanting to make amends for this, once you fire Devin Faraci, one, you don't rehire him. I feel like that shouldn't be a step we have to say, but I guess we have to say it.
And also, don't rehire him in some weird secret backroom deal.
Yes, like, and lie to your employees.
Exactly.
Which is, I think, as gross as lying to the public, because you've got a big company of people who count on you.
Yeah.
And a culture that is created within your company. You are responsible for them. Number one, don't rehire him. Two, make a real effort to show, like, we are filling Devin's job. I would say hire a woman, because there's way too few women in these jobs for writing in the film culture. So do that. And maybe make a bigger show of, like, inclusivity. And, you know, like, now Tim Leake is saying that they're going to have these workshops with Drafthouse and Fantastic Fest staff about, like, you know, gender in the workplace and, like, the culture of all this stuff. It's like, Well, little too late for that, Tim League. Like, too little, yeah. Too late. Like, that would actually have been a great thing to, I think, try to do to show that you were being proactive 10 months ago.
Exactly.
But that's not when you did it. So it's a problem. Yeah, so you know, those are steps you can take. If you're Devin Faraci, don't take the job again and show that you have so little... That's not showing any kind of remorse.
Yeah.
And you do, you know, everyone, as I say, deserves, like, forgiveness and a second chance. But if you go back to, like, any philosophical, biblical, religious writing about those things, they always also have the clause about you need to be sorry for your actions.
Yeah, and like, show some sort of consequences for the actions you've taken.
Yeah, there's no, like, there's no just complete forgiveness. Yeah. No one gets that.
Well, unless, you know, if you're talking about, like, you know, like the Middle Ages, that you can just kind of throw the friar a couple of bucks and it's like, okay, you're good.
Yeah,
you're getting to heaven now, buddy.
Wait, that's not why we do it anymore. But yeah, at least I don't know. The Catholic Church still does some shady stuff. But the Pope seems... this Pope seems like he wouldn't stand for that. I don't know. Anyway, yeah. So that's all, like, so self-evident. I don't even know what else to say. It's just awful.
But, like, the fact that these things have been happening, like, mean that they do... It needs to be said.
Yeah.
Like,
and here's the other thing I want to say. So, I have a couple of opinions tied up here with the Draft House stuff specifically before we get into Fantastic Fest and Harry Knowles and all that grossness. Yeah. But, like, when I said earlier, like, Tim League lying to his employees, that's one of the things that's really sickening to me, because I do love the Alamo Draft Houses here in Denver.
Yeah.
And I go to them a lot. I think they're some of the best theaters around. And I've heard a lot of the calls for, like, boycotting the Alamo Draft House. And I completely understand where people are coming from on that, and I completely support if that's the action you want to take. You are well within your right to do that, and it sends the message that probably needs to be sent. At the same time... You know, if I frequent these locations and I see the people there, there are so many good people who work at these places and are trying to make a difference in the scene. And, you know, the Draft House is now a nationwide chain with all these cool people getting these opportunities to work in the film scene. And to me, the goal isn't shut the Draft House down. It's
make the Draft House better.
And you know, that's not, you know, to me, a boycott of that kind of thing isn't fair at all the people who work there and are good and do good things and get these opportunities. That's punishing. You know, Tim League is rich. You're not going to hurt him by this, you know? If he leaves tomorrow, he leaves on his pile of money that he made on it, you know? And so, you know, I look at, like, the dedication of I see in those employees and that they are, you know, encouraged to their work. And I generally see, you know, women and men working in these, at the Draft House and stuff. And I hope it can be a more inclusive and improving business, not one that needs to be shut down and send all those people out to some other place where there may or may not be better conditions. I don't know. Yeah. So, but that's part of my thought. But that's why, you know, the wanting it to be better for not just the people on the outside, but on the inside, because the conversation is also about inclusiveness within the industry, that the filmmaking industry, the film distribution industry, which is what the Draft House is, that the film, you know, coverage industry, which is like Birth Movies Death and Fantastic Fest. And I want all of those to be better. I don't want them to go away, because obviously there is more to this toxic culture than just these couple of people, and all of that needs to be rectified. But I guess to me, when I look at that, it's I can't think of it as burn it to the ground and start over, because that's never really how this kind of progress is made.
Yeah.
And yes, I think Tim League probably should step down or move into a different role at the company, if for no other reason than, you know, his staff has significant reasons to distrust him.
Yeah.
And that is a big, big problem. And if you believe in the mission of that company and you want it to be better, then again, a step in trying to show that you are sorry and trying to make an improvement is probably one to take yourself out of the scenario and see what you can do on the way out to improve this for all the people who have helped you, have been instrumental in building this business with you.
Yeah.
That's part of my view on it, I guess.
Yeah.
You know, because
I basically agree with all that.
You know, a company of this size is not a single person auteur thing.
Right.
That you can knock that pin down and everything gets fixed. And if you knock the whole thing down, I don't know. I also think, you know, that there are positive things that can come out of all of this. Not all of this, the sexism stuff. I just mean that the business existing and being hopefully a positive place that it tries to be inclusive for people to come and see movies. Like, you know, the Draft House over the summer, we all thought it was pretty cool with the women-only Wonder Woman screenings.
Sure, yeah.
And stuff like that. I want there to be a film distribution space that is exciting and inventive and shows cool things and invites different kinds of people. You know, the Draft House that we go to, you know, here, the programmers there are so good at, you know, I think programming stuff for all kinds of people and audiences. And I want that to be better. And there are these things clearly holding it back, and those need to be improved. to me, like a boycott and shutting down the whole thing, is not the healthiest way to approach that.
Yeah, because it is. It's definitely a. I mean, it's obviously a hugely complex issue of like. I mean, it's just that kind of like question of like what as the consumer in the equation, like what sort of power do you have to influence this stuff? And I agree that because the idea of the boycott feels like it just doesn't. To me, most of the time that we have like boycotts in the 21st century, they don't have any real power. Like, I feel like that's like actually not how late capitalism operates anymore. Is I don't think the boycott is effective. It's not the 18th century. It's not the 19th century. Like, that's not how the economics of this stuff works.
And I should say right now, it's a different thing if you feel personally uncomfortable frequenting that business. That's
If you don't want to go, don't go. But there's a difference between like trying to sort of make an organized boycott and personally deciding like you are not comfortable engaging with this anymore.
That's more than 100% valid to say I don't feel comfortable there.
Absolutely. You have no obligation to go engage with any of this stuff at all. But like, the idea of like the organized boycott, I agree that I just think like the damage that is dealt would not be to the people that you want to do damage to and like to have consequences for. Because there is something in that whole space of that we've talked about a lot about on this podcast of like the theatrical space for cinema right now is generally really in the shitter. And Alamo Drafthouse is obviously this chain that really cares. It's one of like the kind of like the most harsh thing about finding out about a lot of this stuff is like, that's so counter to like the image you have built for this company and like the feels like the community of like cinema lovers that have come around the Alamo Drafthouse. Like, I've only been there a couple of times, but like when we both saw Shin Godzilla there last year, like that was an awesome experience, and having that like ability to go see this like relatively small foreign movie here and like feel like people who put this together and like put the pre-reel together and everything in this experience care about this experience, that's really valuable. And I think if like Drafthouse goes away, I don't know who fills that void, right? So it's a complicated question.
It's a complicated question, and the other thing that comes into this is some of the online reaction I've seen that I also think strikes the wrong tone on the other side of this, which is people who really love the Drafthouse and the Austin film scene I've seen, but mostly men, having trouble articulating a good response to this because they're so into this. They're like, well, okay, Tim and Devin made mistakes, but I kind of forgive it all automatically because I love this. That's not the right thing either.
No.
And, you know, I saw, I'm not going to name names here, but like, one person I saw who I respect said something like, I think Tim did the wrong thing, but I also think Tim League is a good guy, et cetera, et cetera. And to me, it's like, well, that's not the issue at play. Tim might be totally nice in your interactions with him. He might be a good person overall. I don't know. We're talking about this specific action, and this specific action was categorically wrong.
Yeah.
You know, and that specific action needs to be reckoned with. You know, we're not talking about burning the whole person at the stake. You know, so that's part of it to me. Or people like, you know, let's get into the Fantastic Fest thing. Actually, I think it's that one's easier for me than the Drafthouse one. Fantastic Fest might need to go away because that's a more toxic thing. When it's much more, if you actually look at it, that's much more personally dictated by Tim League. It's much more just an Austin-based film thing, and can be a hub for the best parts of the Austin film community, which is a wonderful community in a lot of ways. It can also, and I've heard this before, these allegations are not new necessarily, be a hub for the worst of that film community, which is very much a bro culture that is exclusionary in a lot of ways. And this led this week to the accusations against Harry Knowles. And I just want to say, I have read Ain't It Cool News for a long time. I haven't read it in a while because a lot of my favorite writers had left, but I'd read it off and on for a while. Not specifically for Harry Knowles. I would read his stuff sometimes. I think they've had some interesting people there in the past. But it's always been a very up-and-down thing. And I want to say, if you've ever read Harry Knowles before, this was the least surprising thing I have ever seen. He's a creep. I think he has some interesting qualities, too. I'm not saying he's completely horrible as a person, but he's a creep. And the fact that in his writing, the way he writes about women is really creepy. And people who write about women that way, they're not all sexual harassers, but it sure increases the likelihood.
Yeah.
You know, if you kind of like, okay, people were passing around on Twitter the thing he wrote about, I want to say True Blood at some point. It's a famous snafu. I don't know if he ever viewed it as a snafu, where he was talking about a female vampire who was a virgin. And so every time she got fucked, her hymen would break and then come back and all this stuff.
Right.
Yeah. It is the creepiest fucking piece of writing. Frankly, like, don't seek it out if you're at all easily triggered by these things, because it's really, really gross. You can't read that and then disbelieve any of these accusations against Harry Knowles. And number one, you shouldn't disbelieve those accusations anyway, because rules 1, 2, and 3 is believe women. And then we get to rule... And then maybe get to rule 4, which is that if the man in question has written a lot of creepy things about women in the past, maybe believe women even more, you know? And so that's part of it. You know, Harry Knowles, Devin Faraci, Tim Lee, these are all really big figures in Fantastic Fest. And late breaking today, Fantastic Fest always has one or two secret screenings where, like, people come in and they buy the ticket for a secret, and it's a true secret, like, don't know what we're going to see. Sometimes it's a big movie, sometimes it's an old thing. Here, they found a porno made by Ed Wood that was basically very, very rapey, and that's what they showed. And then they had a Q&A afterwards. It was all today when we're recording this. They had a Q&A afterwards where a woman stood up and asked about what the Austin film scene, Fantastic Fest, the Draft House was going to do in the future to address all these horrible things happening with sexism. And they basically said, you should talk to us in private later, and completely shot down the question.
Jeez.
I mean, that's the point where it's like, okay, here's the clearest example of this being a cultural issue with this scene, not just these couple of guys.
Is that nobody in that process ever thought, maybe this isn't the movie to show? And maybe if we show this movie, we should have a lot of ideas about how to answer these kinds of questions.
Yeah, like, it's just that to me, I mean, that's almost a flippant fuck you. Like, whether you had it planned in advance or not, that feels like the kind of thing that you looked at all this and said, oh, I know how to fuck with these libtards or something. You know,
right.
It just feels horrible, kind of thing you would do. So yeah, Fantastic Fest, I feel much more like, yeah, fuck them. That's really, really bad. And maybe that needs to be purged a little more. But I don't know. It's and a couple of film distributors pulled their movies. There's a movie coming out by Martin McDonagh called Three Billboards Outside of Ebbing, Missouri, with Frances McDormand. It's going to be a big Oscar movie. Sounds like it's really good. It's been touring the festivals. Once they heard about all the rape stuff with Harry Knowles and Tim League, they completely pulled their movie from Fantastic Fest, because their movie is about sexual assault.
Okay,
and I think good on them to make that statement and not show their movie there. There is so much. And again, it's like, and I've seen online people wanting to wave this away because they've had a good time at Fantastic Fest. And it's like,
you can have a good time at Fantastic, or you can have had especially a good time at Fantastic Fest, and then also say, oh, all this shit is bullshit.
Yeah.
This is all bad.
If you
know, it's those things can be true at the same time.
I guess my basic point is, if you go to the Draft House or you've gone to Fantastic Fest and you have felt included there and you have felt like it was tailored to you and your needs and those things, then your reaction should be, man, it is really sad and fucked up that other people have not had that experience.
Yeah.
Because it is specifically doing things that are exclusionary, harmful, harassing to people. And we should all work together to make sure that we can all have that experience that I had and I enjoyed, you know. And that, to me, is the core of it.
Yeah.
It's just empathy, right?
Yeah.
And again, I completely understand if you feel like you can never set foot in a draft house again because of these things, completely within your right and completely understandable. I'm very sad that it has to come to that. No one should have to feel out of place at these spaces. And it is incumbent on the people at the top to take the steps necessary to make people feel included again.
Yeah.
And, you know, ultimately we have this culture where people don't have to be held responsible for their actions. And, you know, PewDiePie making one apology video is not being held responsible for his actions. Devin Faraci quitting a second time, he's still not being held responsible for his actions.
Yeah.
Tim League writing an apology post on Facebook, not being held responsible for his actions. And fucking Harry Knowles, who has just completely denied all the accusations and is being combative.
In, like, the most, like, playbook way possible of, like, oh, no, we were friends and we had a relationship and I deny all this. Like, well, yep. How many times have I fucking seen this statement?
I mean, now we have photographic evidence of, like, text conversations online of him harassing women. I mean, just like, you know, rule of thumb to all the guys out there, if you're talking to a woman online and you're not in, like, an explicit sexual relationship, just don't use the word dick. Just don't do it.
Yeah.
Just don't describe sexual acts. Just, like, you know, I don't know, talk about the weather, movies.
Talk to people like they're people.
Yeah.
That's
a great thing. Yeah. That's a simple way to say it. The world's really fucked up.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're all part of it and we're all responsible and we all need to do better.
Yeah.
And part of that is just talking through this shit.
Yeah. And obviously, like, we are, like, in our own small parts of these, like, cultures and communities of video games and movies. And it's something that we have to, even if it's just on an individual basis, you have to do your best to, like, make sure that these communities are inclusive and healthy for all kinds of people.
check your privilege. You know, I've talked about going to the Draft House many times on this. This is a wake up call for me. If I don't necessarily think I want to boycott the company or that sort of thing, but I still, you know, need, it is my responsibility, I think, knowing these things, to be more on the lookout for anything I see in that company or that culture that I feel is wrong or plays into this, right?
Yeah.
And that becomes your responsibility once you're made aware of it. Doesn't mean you can change it all yourself, but, you know, if something's fucked up, you can say it, you can talk about it. If you hear someone else, you can try to amplify that voice, believe that voice. There are little things we can all do.
Yeah. Or, like, for the video game side of thing, it's something that's like, be nice and pleasant online.
Sure.
Like even if that's something as far as, like, don't teabag people in Halo or whatever. You know, it's just like, whatever, like, if you're using team chat, be nice and friendly. Even if other people are being mean, just be nice and friendly. Like, that goes a long way. Like, just be nice. And that does a lot.
Yeah. So, Sean, we had a hard conversation.
Yes.
We don't usually get this serious on the podcast.
Yeah, I think it was a hard transition from Agent Cody Banks to that. But...
well, okay, yes. Let's transition back. Our reward is, let's do a fun, silly video game topic.
I like some fun, silly video games.
About things that have never hurt anyone, just like, you know, Mario 64 or something. You know? Because that's one of the games we're going to talk about here.
Okay, I mean, if we're talking about Mario Party 1, Mario Party 1 has hurt people in that one video game where you have to spin they were sued
over that.
Yeah.
So this week, at the end of this week, the Super NES Classic is coming out. Hopefully I will have obtained one to review on the podcast this
time. I still think you're just going to, like, there's going to be a box at your doorstep and you're going to open it and it's just empty. There's just, like, one card that's just a middle finger.
Yes, it's Shigeru Miyamoto cheerfully giving you the bird.
But it's, like, it's made out of, like, the packing peanuts. Yes. It's outlined at the bottom of the box. It's like, that's really impressive.
I didn't know Walmart would go to those lengths.
I don't know how they stayed there. That's amazing.
All right, no. So hopefully we're all going to get to play the SNES Classic. The news component of this is that all indications are that Nintendo has been good to their word in gearing up production for the Super NES Classic.
They're relative, putting the NES Classic back out again next year. They're very adamant about, like, we're making more of these things.
Yeah, we've started to see, like, unit numbers stores are going to start to have in stock, and they are indeed much higher than before. Now, does that mean it's going to be easy to get one of these day one? No. Probably not. But it sounds like it's going to be easier in the long run than the NES Classic was, and that's good. And why I wanted to mention that is just to pat Nintendo on the back a little bit.
Sure, yeah.
Proof, you know, in the wings. It's a preliminary pat on the back.
Yeah.
Because if Walmart cancels my order again, I'm going to shiv somebody. But anyway, I'm going to make a shiv out of an existing SNES Classic controller.
Exactly, just to, like, really prove the point. Drive the point home.
Yes, no. But anyway, so it seems like the Classic Edition line by Nintendo is probably here to stay, right?
I would say
We know.
I mean, they've been reselling us their old video games since, like, the Game Boy Advance.
And it seems like
since the Super Nintendo.
And it seems like they've realized this is a popular and easy way to do it. Right?
Yeah.
Now, they have patented the image for an N64 classic, a la the NES and Super NES, which would make sense. The N64 is the follow-up home console to the NES and Super NES.
No classic Virtual Boy, unfortunately, it seems.
I don't think we're going to get that. But
put all of the games on it. It would have been fantastic.
Yes. In anticipation of the N64 or the Super NES Classic, I want to speculate a little bit about what the N64 Classic would be. We're going to joke around about it. We're going to have a little fun. And I looked online last night and decided to try to make a list of what would the 21... I'm doing 21 because that's what the Super NES Classic has.
Right.
And I didn't want to try to get it out to 30. The 21 games that would be on the N64 Classic, I thought about going in a jokey direction with this, but I decided... it actually is enough fun on its own. Let's try to do the serious version and try to consider the implications of could they get the rare games and things like that. So
before we get into this, I just want to emphasize I was not involved in the creation of this list. I have no idea what's on this list. I have some ideas probably about some of the major games that would be on this. But, like, if this is a terrible list, it's not my fault.
Yeah.
I just want to, you know, make that very clear.
And I very much tried to model this after the lists we got for the NES and the Super NES. And I think part of my goal was, you and I have joked before about the N64 has a pretty thin library of games.
Yes, it does.
Like, could you put together an N64 Classic that would sound like a good package with a similar number of games?
Okay.
And surprisingly, I think you could, if for no other reason than the list I put together winds up being, I think, a pretty fascinating snapshot of a very important and transitional moment in game history.
Okay.
But we're going to do this alphabetical order, okay?
Yeah, because obviously they're not, like, ranked in quality or anything.
No. Alphabetical order. Number one is Banjo-Kazooie.
Okay, yeah. Banjo-Kazooie.
Now, I have two rare games on this list, and I'll just spoil another one is GoldenEye. We'll get there.
GoldenEye would never be on there for licensing issues. No, but...
But I'm trying to say, like, okay, you really... If you're going to do a legitimate version of the N64 Classic, it would be very hard to do that without some representation by Rare, right?
Oh, yeah. No, absolutely. Yeah.
Now, they have not ever been able to re-release those Rare games on Nintendo consoles. They've gone to other places. Yeah,
they're on
but
Xbox now.
If you look at NES and Super NES Classics, they've done enough of bringing back games that they have not traditionally re-released, sometimes with publishers they don't work with as much anymore, that I think it could happen. I do think Banjo-Kazooie is the one most likely that they could get. And who knows, important moment, maybe Heaven and Earth can be moved and something can happen with GoldenEye, which has never been re-released in any form.
Yeah. Is Donkey Kong Country or any of the Donkey Kong Country games on the SNES?
Yeah, Donkey Kong Country 1 is. Yeah,
so that was a Rare game. So,
but they've always had that one because it's their character, so it's a little easier.
Well, then why wouldn't it be Donkey Kong 64 on the N64?
No, I have that on there.
Okay, that's also a Rare game.
That is a Rare game?
Yeah.
Okay, well, they've re-released Donkey Kong 64 on the Wii U, so that one's fine.
There you go. Yeah.
All right.
So if they couldn't get Banjo and the Kazooie, they could get Donkey Kong the 64.
And I'm thinking we only get Banjo-Kazooie, not Banjo-Tooie, because that would be a step too far. I'm sure it's a great game. I'm just saying.
Yeah.
Yeah, anyway. So number two is Castlevania Legacy of Darkness, because they've had Castlevania games on both the NES and the Super NES.
Yeah.
Now, sadly, the Castlevania games on N64 are flaming hot shit.
Uh-huh.
But I think it would still be interesting from a historical perspective to have them.
Sure.
This is the special edition of Castlevania 64, so I think it's the version they would include. And, you know, I think Capcom's up for it. They're not making games anymore, so fuck it. They'll chill it out.
Yeah.
They're not quite into the Konami space of being really gross about it.
Yeah.
But, yeah, they're just licensing these days. Three and four are two Donkey Kong games. We have Diddy Kong Racing and Donkey Kong 64. Donkey Kong 64 is obvious. That would have to be on there.
Yeah.
Diddy Kong Racing is, I think, the kind of like nice little obscurity that people still have fond memories of that they like to pepper on these collections.
Yeah.
So I think you'd get it. I think you'd get that.
Yes.
Number five, also a racing game, F-Zero X.
Because okay, right, yes. Yeah, there was an F-Zero game on the 64.
They have F-Zero 1 on the Super NES. I think they would bring it back. They have not re-released this one on Virtual Console for the Wii U at least, but I think they'd do it.
Yeah.
So we have that.
I can see that.
Number seven is Kirby 64, the Crystal Shards. Yeah. Just obvious.
That's a good game.
If you
put the lightning and cutter powers together, you get the Darth Maul lightsaber. Yeah. And that's pretty cool.
Next we have, we get into the part of the alphabet that is M, so we have some Marios.
Okay.
That's not even all the Mario games. Mario Kart 64,
just obvious. Yeah.
Mario Party 2. Now, I think they would not include all of the three Mario Party games.
No, I mean, that would be only if they're very desperate to fill out that lineup.
Yeah, one, they're never re-releasing Mario Party 1. They never have, they never will. They got sued up the ass for it.
Yeah.
Mario Party 3, like, I think it would be between 2 and 3, but 2 is the better one, and I think fans like it more. It's the one they have on the Wii U Virtual Console, so I think we'd get Mario Party 2.
You don't want those battle mini-games or whatever, their dual mini-games or whatever Mario Party 3 has?
I like Mario Party 3, but Mario Party 2 better. Okay, and then 10... This is when Mario sports games started getting big, and I think you have to have one of them representative here. And so I picked Mario Tennis.
Okay. Yeah.
Now, this was the first Mario Tennis game, unless you count the Virtual Boy. So this is the first Mario Tennis game.
Okay.
It's also the first appearance of Waluigi ever. It's the first appearance of Daisy in her modern 3D form, because Daisy had only been the name of a character who you really don't see in Mario Land for the Game Boy.
Right.
And this is the return of Birdo, first 3D Birdo. I mean, look at that lineup. That's historic. You've got to have Mario Tennis on there.
Of course. I mean, everyone knows from having played Super Mario Brothers 2 how much Birdo loves tennis.
Yes. Now, number 11, here's another tough one because I mentioned earlier a Castlevania game. I feel like you kind of have to follow Castlevania into 3D because you did it on the NES and SNES.
Sure.
They also on the NES and SNES had Mega Man. And Capcom is always happy to put Mega Man out. So I think you have to have Mega Man 64. It's also a flaming hot piece of garbage.
I think Capcom forgot that they made Mega Man 64.
You can get it on the PS3 and PS Vita. It's on PS1 Classics. I forget what it's called there, but Mega Man 64 is the same game as Mega Man on PlayStation. So you can get it.
Okay, I rented that game once. I don't remember much about it.
Not very good. Number 12, Paper Mario.
Yeah, absolutely.
We have a lineup of Stone Cold Classics coming up.
You mean number one, Paper Mario.
Yeah. But we're going to have Paper Mario on there, obviously. We're going to have Pokemon Snap.
Yes.
You're going to have Pokemon Stadium 2. Because
Pokemon Stadium 2000.
Okay.
As it was properly titled.
Pokemon Stadium 2, because you're probably not going to include both Pokemon Stadiums, and the second one is better.
Yeah, I mean, it's just got more Pokemon.
Here's one that at first I thought would be unlikely, but then I remembered it's been re-released on both DS and 3DS, and that's Rayman 2, The Great Escape.
Okay,
that would be a really...
I think of the Rayman games as being PlayStation games, but it was on the N64 as well.
Yeah, and this was a... Well, and it was on the N64 first. This one was made for N64 first, and it's it was released, for instance, it was a launch game on the 3DS as Rayman 3D, so they continue to have a good relationship. The new Rayman one is also on Switch, so, like, I think that would happen.
I love that you pronounce it Rayman, not Rayman.
What did I... Was I saying Rayman?
People say it Rayman.
Oh, Rayman, sorry.
It's like Rayman.
Rayman. Everybody loves Rayman, Sean. Yeah.
He's great.
I can't wait for the Everybody Loves Rayman movie where he's voiced by Ray Romano.
Sure.
That's Rayman. Rayman. I don't know.
Did that joke went somewhere?
All right. We've got... Okay, the rest of this list is Stone Cold Classics.
Okay.
I'm just going to list them. Star Fox 64.
Yeah, that's a good game.
Super Mario 64.
That's a very good game.
Super Smash Brothers.
It's harder than you remember the Super Mario 64, I think.
Super Smash Brothers.
Very good, yeah.
Great game. Legend of Zelda Ocarina of Time.
Yep.
Legend of Zelda Majora's Mask.
Yep.
And Yoshi's Story.
Sure, that's an okay game.
Yeah. You'd have to have it, right?
Yeah.
And then I thought, okay, so that's 21. I think that's actually a surprisingly good lineup.
That's a decent lineup. You've got that Castlevania game. I can't vouch for the quality of that F-Zero game. Donkey Kong 64 is not that good.
I kind
of
like
Yoshi's Story's okay.
But I think you have to have them. Like, if you're trying to do the, like, and this is what
I mean, I'm not saying that there are a lot of N64 games that are better than those. I'm just saying they're not that good.
I'll read you some of the ones I left off in a minute, and we'll just talk about those, because some of them were so pie in the sky that they were never going to happen. But, like, I do think that's an interesting list, because you have a ton of Stone Cold Classics on, a good amount of Stone Cold Classics.
Yeah, you've got Paper Mario, Pokemon Snap, Super Mario 64, and Ocarina of Time.
Yeah. And you have some other
Smash Brothers. I'd say Smash Brothers.
Smash Brothers. You have some really, really good ones on that list. Even second tier, like Majora's Mask, Star Fox 64, Kirby 64. Not, like, the best games ever, but really worth having.
Yeah.
And then you've got some other ones, and I think this would give a good idea of what the N64 was, some of the highs and the lows. I think that would be a good, worthwhile list of games.
Sure.
Now, I did think... Now, what if they did a bonus game the way they did Star Fox 2 on the Super NES? What would that be? And Thomas and I, my brother, were actually brainstorming on this, because there's not as obvious a choice. But we came up with it. The original N64 version of Animal Crossing from Japan, which was an N64 game before it was on GameCube. They do have the translation, because it's basically just a GameCube game. Throw that on there. Bonus game.
Sure. I mean, only for the Western market is it a bonus game, but yes.
Sure. Well, for the Japanese, it's just, they get it. 22 games.
Okay, sure.
Yeah, it's not bonus.
Fuck you. You don't get no bonus game. You just get normal-ass Animal Crossing. Yeah.
Some of these are alphabetized, but okay. In rough order, here are the ones I left off and was considering for various reasons. Banjo-Tooie, because they're not going to get both.
That's true. I mean, they probably wouldn't even get one.
Probably not, but we'll see. Doom 64... would be cool to have. I think they could get it. I don't think they would put it on there.
No, yeah.
Even if Doom is going to be on the Switch, I don't think they're doing that. It'd be cool to have.
I mean, I think Doom 64 is the version that has, like, different music and it's all weird.
Well, it's technically a different... It's got a lot of different levels and stuff. It's bizarre. Okay, then two Star Wars games, Rogue Squadron and Shadows of the Empire.
Sure, yeah.
They'd be great to have. They're not happening. Because, like, this, I would love to have the Super Star Wars games on the SNES Classic, but they're not getting those.
Yeah.
So, let's see. Spider-Man 64, which is the N64 version of the PlayStation game.
Yeah.
Great game.
Great game. That wouldn't happen. PC.
Yeah, that wouldn't happen, but it's really worth playing if you've never seen it. Or at least watching some clips. Stanley narrates.
Yeah, it's very good.
The original Pokemon Stadium, because they're only going to do one. Pilot Wings 64. I think that might show up if they actually did it.
Yeah, I think that would absolutely be on there if they actually
did
it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Because that was like, it was like that in Super Mario 64 were the launch games for the N64.
Yeah, so we'll see. Mario Party 3 and Mario Party 1, I explained my reasoning there. Mario Golf, I think tennis would be the more enticing of those. Dr. Mario 64, didn't know that was a game.
Neither did I.
Yeah.
Maybe that's the bonus game. It's bonus because everybody forgot it.
Yeah. One that I also think very much could make it as a dark horse, especially if you took the rare games off, is Harvest Moon 64.
Sure, yeah.
But they didn't have Harvest Moon on the SNES Classic, which leads me to believe it's not a priority for them. And they could get it. The Harvest Moon games are on, they still publish them, so I think they could get it. And then the one that I really wanted to include and come up with some pie-in-the-sky thing where they would include the peripheral necessary in the box for this thing is Hey You Pikachu.
Yes.
Because I love the idea of an N64 classic where they give you like two controllers and the microphone for Hey You Pikachu.
Yes. That's just, that's all 100%. That's what it should be.
Yes.
That should just be the only game. That's what, like, the N64 classic. It's just that the thing is just, like, bolted into the controller and you just get Hey You Pikachu.
Yep. So feel free, to argue with me on this, swap games in and out. I would love to hear your own lists and what suggestions you have. I'd also like to remind us all, here's how thin the N64 list is. How I compiled this is I found an alphabetical list on Wikipedia of every game ever published for the N64, and I was able to go through it game by game and make this list. Would be an impossible task for most consoles.
Yeah, that's like, that'd be like 800 games or something like that on the NES.
Yeah, no, on the N64 I was able to do that in about 20 minutes. So I do think I found all the good ones.
Okay. I've got like a couple of things to consider here from my own history with the N64. Gauntlet Legends was a pretty good game. I'd maybe throw that in there. It's a gauntlet game on the N64. Okay. It's a good multiplayer game. So you could get that on there. You don't have any fighting games on there, which I understand because there were no good fighting games on the N64. None. I have two candidates, though. One of them, no. One of them would probably actually be on there. The no one is Clay Fighter 63 and a third. Terrible fucking game. I think it was a Blockbuster exclusive.
Are you going to say Ready to Rumble Boxing?
No. Okay. Sure, we'll throw that Ready to Rumble Boxing.
That was my parents, when they got me my N64 for Christmas, I had Smash Bros. And Ready to Rumble Boxing.
My condolences. The other one,
I'll remind you all that Sonic 06 is the first game I ever played in HD. Move on.
You've lived a sad life, Jonathan. We all know that. But the actual fighting game, because I'm like 95% sure that this was also released on the N64, would be Killer Instinct. Okay. I think they could get Killer Instinct. I don't think they'd get Banjo-Kazooie, but I think they could maybe swing Killer Instinct. Okay. That would be the one fighting game I could kind of envision being on there.
So here's the thing. I think from our discussion and my list and suggestions you could make and things we could swap in and out, I think you could get the games on there to make this worthwhile.
Sure.
I think you can have
Because also you don't necessarily need 20 games. Like, I could see them cutting that list down because they are bigger games in at least like data size than the Super Nintendo game would be.
I'd want at least 20 because I think I could get a list of 20 out of all of these, the ones I included and didn't, that I think you would want those 20, 21 games.
Sure.
The thing for me that is the huge question mark that I'm sure Nintendo engineers are scratching their heads about is, what do you do about the controllers? How do you replicate them easily?
Uh-huh.
Do you want to replicate them exactly? Because you could make a really cute little N64. That's not a problem, right?
Oh, absolutely.
But then it's, what do you do with the replica controllers? Because the N64 controllers are horrible.
Yeah.
You also ideally would want four of them because so many of these are four-player multiplayer experiences.
Yeah, like Mario Party would be useless if it only had one or two controllers.
And the SNES Classic does have two, so I think it would have at least two, and that'd be fine. But like, you'd have to be able to have people buy more. What do you do? Like, My joke was that they include one N64 controller and one Xbox 360 controller. Just like they get some extras from Microsoft.
Yeah, you know, they just hand them out.
Yeah, just like they get some extra Steam controllers because those aren't selling.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know what you do.
It's like, whatever happened to the Ouya? They had controllers, didn't they? Let's get those.
It's just like, that is to me the biggest, because if you wanted this, I think this might cost a little more than, let's say, so the NES Classic was 60, I think. The Super NES Classic is 80. I think this might go up to 99. But then the question really becomes, how can you manufacture those controllers easily and well enough to really like ship them with this? Do people even want them like that? That to me is the biggest question mark hanging over the N64 Classic.
Yeah, it is, because I think the only answer to that is you just fucking make the same controller. Obviously, like, the materials would be updated and stuff. So, like, presumably, you know, that fucking analog stick would not be made out of, like, compressed chalk or whatever the fuck that weird dust was that probably we are all going to get cancer from it at some point. That's my guess. That can't have been good for us. That shit was bad. Like if you haven't looked at an N64 controller lately, but you still have some, go look at those and, like, look at, like, the pit that the control stick is in, because it's disturbing how much powder is just in there, like, baked into the controller.
It's pretty fucked up.
Yeah, but, yeah, because it's, like, part of you wants, like, the redesigned version of the controller where you can, crazy idea, access every single button on the controller from the same position, the way every other controller ever has been made, and that is the one that we're like, let's make it so that only two-thirds of the controller are ever accessible to the player at any given moment. Let's build a controller that way. Ideally, you would want one that, you know, was made like a normal human controller, but the whole point of this thing is it's like a nostalgia play.
Yeah.
And what's the point of a nostalgia play if it's only the good stuff? We need, like, the weird quirks as well.
It is the weird thing. Like, the thing is, if you do the NES or Super NES Classic and the nostalgia play, it's great to play those games with those controllers.
Yeah, those controllers are still fine.
Yeah, in fact, the SNES controller, a lot of people still love that form factor. I'm one of those people. nobody loves the form factor of the N64 controller. Yeah. So I think one option would be to do a redesign of something that is easier for everybody. But as you say, then that takes away the nostalgia factor. And nostalgia can be good and bad.
Yeah.
Anyway, this has been a silly, dumb discussion just for fun.
And obviously the bonus game should be Superman 64. Like, that's what we should not bury our history, Jonathan. It has to live with us so we don't do it again. I rented that game.
Okay, Sean. Got a tough question for you.
Uh-huh.
So would you rather?
Okay.
Would you rather watch the 3-hour R-rated extended cut of Batman v Superman Dawn of Justice in its entirety?
Okay, yeah.
Or play Superman 64 to the end credits?
Oh, watch Batman v Superman.
Okay.
Absolutely. Have you ever played any of Superman 64?
No, I just know how much you hate that movie.
It is. You should play some Superman 64. That should be. We should do a video. I'm not playing it. I am not playing it. But I will sit and watch you play that game so you can know. So you can fucking know. Because you play 1 second of that game and you know that's the worst fucking video game ever made. Like, easy. Easy that I've played. God, I can't even imagine. Because it would be longer, way longer than 3 hours. Because it's not like that game has that much content, but just trying to get through the first level is a massive pain in the butt.
I think I now know if I'm architecting your hell, like your purgatory, the only game you can play is Superman 64, and while you do it, Jesse Eisenberg's Lex Luthor, his dialogue runs on a loop in your ears.
Yeah, because that's the one golden, shining, only bright spot of Superman 64, is it is based on the animated series, so it's those art designs, it's got the great, like, flying sound effect from that cartoon, and I believe it's those voice actors, or it's like people trying to like do an approximation of Clancy Brown as Lex Luthor. So if you took that performance of Lex Luthor out and then put Jesse Eisenberg in, yes, that would be, I would yank the analog stick out of the N64 controller and slit my throat with a jagged edge.
Because you know it's a jagged edge.
Yes, it absolutely is.
Did you hear, getting off topic, that it's the rumor that Jesse Eisenberg has been cut completely from Justice League?
Yeah, I mean, it would have been nice if like the rumor had been like he's being cut from the director's cut. He was cut from the extended edition of Batman v Superman. It's extended because he's not in it anymore. That's better.
Yes. No.
Yeah.
It sounds like Joss Whedon is just remaking the movie.
Yeah, that seems to be where they're at with that one.
Joss Whedon also was an ass to his wife for like 20 years. So
yeah, that was another big one.
There are no heroes.
Yeah.
All right, let's move on. Quick Patreon shout-outs.
Right,
this is probably our last podcast of September, because September's a short month.
Yes.
And we'll be recording on October 1st, the next one. So, quick Patreon shout-outs. It's the same two Patreons as last time, who have the $15 level. That's Mr. Barry Donnelly.
Yep. Thank you very much.
And Mr. Kenneth Serenyi. I think that's how I pronounce his name. Yeah. We talked about them last month. Kenneth, once upon a time, donated to get us our first microphones. Love him for that. Love some of the comments he's had. He's had some fun things he's posted over on our Patreon if you look at the community chat and stuff. And Barry, I think it was you who posted when I put up the Mario 64 videos 2 weeks ago. He said something about this timestamp, that was glorious or something. And I looked at the timestamp and was like, what was he talking about? And it's the moment where I fell off the map right after getting the first star, and I didn't actually get the first star on the snow level.
Uh-huh.
And I was just like, thanks, Barry. I had to relive that.
Yeah, you've got a lot of good stuff waiting ahead for you if you like that one, Barry.
Yep. All right, so thank you guys for being our patrons. If you would like to join our Patreon, they get a shout-out because they're at the $15 level. I need to get better about posting a more consistent Q&A thing. It was off a little bit in September because
our schedule dates moved. Stuff.
Yeah, but we'll get that worked out in October. And thank you guys for pledging. And we will be back in a second. We're going to take a break. Won't be a break for you guys. To talk about Metroid Samus Returns and Destiny 2 and an October game preview.
All right.
So, Sean, this has been a very emotionally up and down couple hours of podcasting.
Yeah, I mean, we talked about Superman 64. We talked about Agent Cody Banks. We talked about sexism and racism in gaming and movie communities.
And
it's been a whole podge of topics.
But now I get to talk about an unreserved high for me, which is Metroid Samus Returns.
All right.
On the 3DS, which is one of the best games of the year. Might be the best game on the 3DS. It's that, or one of the Fire Emblems, or Zelda Link Between Worlds, and they'll have to fight it out, in my mind. But it's an amazing, amazing game. And I know this because I have now beat the game twice in the span of 1 week, or 1.5 weeks.
Right.
And I never do that. But I want to describe some of the process for this, because When I talked about Metroid Samus Returns last week, I was on the cusp of getting to like the last area, but I wasn't there yet. And the last part of the game didn't like dramatically change my opinion, but it did solidify all the stuff I think this game does spectacularly well. Just like the last few hours of this game, one, they're insane in terms of difficulty. The bosses, the last three major bosses that they throw at you are nuts. They are so creative. They are so demanding. They are so challenging and grueling. And I do think it is a criticism you could levy at the game that the normal default difficulty, and there's no slider at first, you have to beat the game to up it, and there's no lower, is ridiculously hard, especially compared to other Metroid games. Like, you know how Metroid, the health, it's not, you know, in Zelda you have hearts, but in Metroid you have the energy tanks, and each one has 99 hit point or health points. There are enemies who will just, with one hit, take out like 5 ticks of health.
Oh, Jesus.
You know, you can die in a couple of hits in one of these boss fights, and that's on the normal difficulty. Now, I have played a lot of Metroid, and this game, like, I think has a lot of tools to help you be good at it, so I was able to get through it, even though a lot of the bosses I had to play over and over again, which I was fine with, because I think it's fun, and that's part of the way bosses like this in this kind of game are designed, is you have to learn their patterns and stuff. Right. I would just warn, while overall I think Metroid Samus Returns, if you've never played a Metroid, absolutely, this is a great introduction to the series, with the asterisk that it is really hard, and there probably should be an option on there for like a like if this is normal, there should be an easy, right, especially for kids or first-time players, because it's really brutally difficult. And I played it through again in the more brutally difficult mode and still had fun with it, so that didn't ever take away from the fun for me, but it's just worth knowing.
Yeah, difficulty options are nice. People,
yes,
you should put them in unless you have a very good, compelling reason why it shouldn't be there.
And it just actually surprised me a little bit, because Nintendo has had this thing like since the mid-days of the Wii, where they've kind of really reveled in making very hard games in all their series, but that means they've added some options for kids and people who don't want to deal with that. Like, you know, there could be someone who helps you run through the level, or there's an easy mode or something. And I like that, because it, to me, like, that frees Nintendo to go insane with their level design while also appealing to the wide audience. And I was just surprised that Samus Returns didn't have that. On the same hand, this game is It's for the hardcore in some ways.
Sure.
Like, it is a love letter to Metroid and to the people who love it. But the final hours of Samus Returns, you're getting through those bosses, it's hard. And then, like, once you've kind of beat the main part of the story, or you're getting near the end game, so many cool things happen. Like, you know, this game sort of exists in a similar space as Metroid Zero Mission, in that it's a remake, but also a reimagining of an older Metroid game. And one of the things people always say about Zero Mission is, man, the ending is so surprising and cool and different. And that's absolutely true. Zero Mission, like, you basically beat what is the main playthrough of Metroid, and then there's a kind of, like, playable epilogue that happens that is so cool. And I'm not even... It's like an 11-year-old game. I'm not going to spoil it. What they do there is amazing and awesome. And I think Metroid Samus Returns has something that is almost as cool and awesome in how they kind of wrap up the story. Because if you... And I won't spoil exactly how they do it, but I'll just say, in the Metroid lore, you might know that the ending of Super Metroid involves that one last Metroid coming back and saving Samus, and it's a really great video game ending. And a lot of that is set up by the events of Metroid 2, and Samus Returns kind of takes our knowledge of where that goes and runs with it, and does so many cool things. And you leave that game on such a high. And the other reason is because when you're about ready to wrap up the game, this game is really accessible to completionists if you want to do a 100% run. Because I didn't just beat this game twice. I beat it twice with 100% completion. That means I got every single item in the game.
That's arguably neurotic.
Arguably neurotic, but it was so much fun. Because, like, I have never gotten 100% completion in a Metroid game, because they can be kind of tough, especially on a first playthrough. And I've played most Metroid games just once. But I really still love the act of going around and collecting. It's something I also love about the Zelda series. And I have done 100% runs on Link to the Past, Link's Awakening, Link Between Worlds, like all the 2D ones with Link in the title, I guess, I've done. I think I also did 100% on, might have been the Wind Waker. It was one of the 3D ones I played recently. I've definitely not done it on Ocarina of Time, but I could have, I guess, at some point, maybe. But I do like doing that. And one of the great things about Samus Returns is it has a robust enough map system and, like, enough little indications for you. It doesn't, like, play the game for you, and that it just shows you, like, here's every single upgrade and what it is and how to get it. But it helps you, like, find all that information in the game. I got 100% twice. I never had to crack a walkthrough or anything online. I was just able to figure it out. And the process of going back through each zone and seeing, like, oh, now I have this power and I can use that here and I can get this item, and now I have to traverse over here and they've given me this thing with the screw attack or something and I can do that now. It's so much fun. And Part of it is that this game has so many good upgrades. Like, if you like the process in a Metroid game of getting, you know, the new suits and the new abilities and all that stuff, Samus Returns has more upgrades than any Metroid game, and Samus feels so crazy powerful by the end, which is part of why I think the difficulty gets so steep near the end, is it would be easy to make the game too easy with how much Samus has to work with. And the part of the fun of doing your completion run and finishing it all near the end is you have all your abilities to work with and can just run around and kind of explore to your heart's content. And it's one of the great strengths of Samus Returns. It's got a really interesting structure where the game is very open and non-linear in that, you know, you basically just have this objective of you have to kill this many number of Metroids and you can kind of go where you need to do that. But it's not one giant nonlinear area. It winds up being a series of kind of cordoned off areas where, like, in area one, you have to get, like, 3 Metroids. And then you'll open up another area. Now you have 7 or something. And each one, I think, is a really good, like, microcosm of what 2D Metroid does so beautifully, which is this big open space, and you just have to go explore it and find your way around it. And it's one of my favorite things in video games that a lot of other art mediums can't replicate, is that feeling of getting lost. Mm-hmm. And not getting lost in the frustrating sense, like, oh man, where the hell do I go in this game? But just, wherever you go, you'll probably be rewarded with some piece of information, even if that information is, well, I can't go this way yet, but now I have a clue, you know, right. And I can go somewhere. And you know, Metroid does this, Zelda does this, Zelda did that beautifully this year with Breath of the Wild, which is a huge open world exploration of that idea. But I think Samus Returns does it really well, and that kind of microcosm thing where it's a series of, like, these little open environments, I think is really smart because it gives you all of that, but it also gives you this constant hit of, like, putting all the pieces together and moving on, and so you get that rush, and then you get to start it over again. And then, you know, near the end of the game, if you want to go back through, there's still things you won't have found in all of those areas.
Right.
So it's just, it's so, if you like that side of Metroid, this game is just, it's so great. It's like just the best drug in the world being injected straight into your veins. It's perfect. But it's Metroid.
Okay.
I love it. So anyway, so there's all of that. I beat the game. I was on such a high. Like, this game was so fucking good, and I had so much fun. And I just didn't want to stop playing it. Like, part of it is Samus Returns plays so fucking well. Like, maybe better than any other Metroid game, 2D or 3D. Like, Samus's movement is so smooth. All of her abilities feel so, like, perfect to execute. You feel there's so many abilities you can use, but they all feel so intuitive and have all sorts of different uses throughout. It's just such a heavily playable, fun game that even after beating it, because it's not a heavily narrative game, it was like, I want to play more.
Right.
And the only way to play more is to start again. And I had the Metroid amiibo, a little squishy guy, which means I could unlock fusion mode. Now, when you beat the game once, you get a hard mode. That's, like, the harder than normal mode, obviously. But if you have an amiibo, then you can unlock fusion mode, which is a step up from hard mode. And you also have the fusion suit from Metroid Fusion, which, as everyone knows, is the coolest looking Samus suit.
Sure.
The yellow and blue thing. And the version in Samus Returns looks fucking awesome. And is basically Mercury Steam doing an audition to remake Metroid Fusion at some point. Which I thought I never needed in my life. I love Metroid Fusion, but it's fine as a GBA game. If the suit will look that cool, I'm up for it. Anyway, and in 3D, you know, it looked really neat. But anyway, so you get the fusion suit. When they say it's harder, though, they're not fucking around. This is, like, actually early in the game is some of the hardest stuff, because when you have, like, 1 or 2 tanks of energy, pretty much any hit from anything will just kill you. And you have to get really good at using all the abilities they give you to make it through. And just the basic traversal can be tough, let alone the actual boss fights. But I had a lot of fun with it, because you really have to master the game to get through this. It kind of feels like Halo on Legendary or something.
Right.
When you see, like, you kind of realize combinations of tools at your disposal that you never would have thought of on an easier difficulty, even as hard as the normal mode is. So I thought Fusion Mode was a blast, and I really started playing it just to kind of dick around and see what it was like. And I just, before I knew it, I'd killed half the Metroids and was halfway through the game. And I'm like, I'm just going to play the game again. It is so good. And I just got lost in it again. And normally, by the end of a second playthrough like that, so close after, I would feel some fatigue. I did not. I just was completely obsessed with this game 2 times through. And I was trying to rack my brain, like, what's the last time I did this? And it would probably be Doom from last year,
yeah,
which I did play 2 times through back to back. But I also, like, I didn't 100% Doom 2 times through back-to-back. I did the second run so I could go back and get all the trophies and stuff. Metroid, I just completely binged, like, obsessively, neurotically, 2 in a row. And that should tell you how good this game is. If you have any love for the Metroid series or any interest in it, this is an absolute must-play game. It is so good on just about every level. One of my favorite games of the year. And This and Fire Emblem Echoes being the two of the big 3DS games this year is amazing, because I don't know which one is better, but they're possibly like the two best games released on the system. And it's the 3DS is still cooking. Because that's the other thing, is that Metroid Samus Returns really proves to me that the 3DS is still a viable system. Not just because the 3D in the game is really cool, which it is, and I talked about last time, but also there's something about playing this game on a handheld like this with the two screens, which makes all the map and collection stuff really nice and convenient, because you don't have to pause and look around. You can often just glance down and see where you're going, which I've always loved about the DS. But also, I think there's something about 2D Metroid and that experience that having it just intimate in your hands, kind of like you're reading a book, feels really good. Because there's so much atmosphere, and you have that, the 3D, your headphones on. It would be cool to have this game on Switch and put it up on the big TV. I might argue it would lose a little bit of its magic. And I'm someone who really loves portable gaming, even if I'm not taking it outside of the house. Sometimes it's nice just to curl up in a chair you wouldn't normally play a game in and play that and have it be this really intimate experience. And I think Metroid, the Fire Emblems, a lot of these are really good examples of that. And you know, I like that the Switch, you can do that just for that experience, you know, taking it into another room, let alone taking it outside of the house. But I do think, like, Samus Returns makes great use of the 3DS, and I don't remember if I joked about this on the air last week or not, but we got Fire Emblem Echoes, which is a remake of Fire Emblem Gaiden, which is like the Black Sheep Fire Emblem sequel. We got Metroid Samus Returns, great reimagining of the Black Sheep Metroid sequel, Metroid 2. We clearly need a 3DS remake of Zelda 2, The Adventure of Link, right?
Yes, we do, yeah.
It could be so cool if they did it with, like, this level of care and imagination, and I think the 3DS would be perfect for it. But, yeah, the 3DS is not going gently into that good night.
No, it is sticking around.
It's sticking around. We're going to get Persona Q at some point, Persona Q 2.
Right.
So we've got more Persona games coming to it. There's going to be more Persona games on this than there is on the PS4 right now. Well, eventually we're going to have the two dancing games.
Yes.
So there you go. But yeah, it's insane. All right. You have any Metroid thoughts?
No, it's been a long time since I played any Metroid stuff.
Yeah. Well, it's been a long time since a new one was released.
That's true. Yeah.
No.
When do you think, because obviously they're working on Metroid Prime 4, but do you think they'll ever make another 2D Metroid game?
You know, this one apparently has sold pretty well and has had a lot of positive reception. Mercury Steam, the developers on this, I mean, it was co-developed with a lot of Nintendo people, as they tend to do with this, hit this so far out of the park. If they're not looking at the sales and, like, maybe thinking about gearing that team up for either... they could do a Fusion remake, and that could be interesting. I would love them to go on and basically do what would be Metroid 5. Because you have Metroid 1, 2, Super Metroid, and Fusion. And Fusion at the beginning actually says Metroid 4. I would love to see, like, Metroid 5, like a 2D game. Because Fusion is so far the furthest point in the timeline. Go on from that. I think that could be really cool.
What about this? What if they made Metroid the Other or M?
Don't think they're going to do that.
Okay. I mean, it's just, I'm just putting that idea out there, you know. Yeah. Like, if you're going to, like, keep on pushing the Metroid franchise into the future.
I do love Metroid came back with something this good. Hopefully bodes well for Metroid Prime 4. We still don't know who's working on it.
Right,
but I assume Nintendo will get good people.
They have a logo for it, and that's reassuring.
That is very reassuring. We don't have the full title, because 2 and 3 both have subtitles. So I want to know what Metroid Prime 4 is.
I already told you, the Other M.
Oh,
we're there.
All right. Well, anyway, Sean, Destiny 2.
Yes.
I don't know how much we have to say, but I wanted to do a check-in. What have you been noticing with the game this last week? What's piqued your attention? Any complaints? More praise? I don't know. We talked a lot about it last time.
Yeah. Like, I honestly don't think my thoughts are very different, because I think it's basically kind of like I've just been doing kind of the same stuff of. I still think, like, the strike playlist needs to be have better rewards and stuff like that. I think, like, they just haven't found a good spot for that, how that fits in next to Crucible and, like, the harder, like, Nightfall raid stuff, and then, like, the more, like, sort of casual public event, just, like, go fuck around on the planet stuff. I feel like there is a niche there for the strikes to fill, and they haven't quite structured enough around there for it to fully fit in there. I still enjoy doing the strikes because I think they're fun, but there's something that kind of nags at you of, like, this doesn't feel like it's fitting into, like, my larger plan for my character or whatever, the way that everything else does easier. But I really am liking Crucible a lot. I've been playing a lot of Crucible, which is
Crucible's
something that...
so good.
Like, I barely ever played Crucible in Destiny 1 past the first week or so in this, like... And even then, in that first week, I just, like, kind of dabbled in it and then eventually kind of fell away from it. And in this, I'm really enjoying it. I think there's a lot more nuance there. And it's just... It feels like a more competitive shooter that is interesting, because it also feels very different than the other competitive shooters on the market, even, like, different than, like, the classic Bungie Halos. This has a very specific flow to a match. And I think, like, having to coordinate with a team, even just, like, if you're not, like, talking to them, but just, like, knowing how your team is moving around the map and knowing where to go yourself to help the team. Like, I think I'm, like, getting a good sense of, like, strategies on how to play the game in that sense that I think is really interesting, and I like that a lot.
I think Crucible is the best part of the endgame. I think it's outstanding. Yeah. I think it gets better with each passing day, and you can just tell that, I think, as the player base gets to know it better and gets more experience with it, it's getting better, and sometimes that's the opposite. So it's really good that it's, like, it's amazing how many matches I've had in Crucible where it is really close. Like, you're getting down to the wire, and, like, we've been trading the lead the whole time. That very rarely happens in online multiplayer shooters like this. So that's really cool that I think they've really, you can tell the balance is very finely honed when it feels that competitive. It's very rarely a rout one way or the other. Yeah. I've even started doing more of the competitive playlist. I'm kind of wary of it because that has one game mode in competitive that I very much don't like, which is the charge one that you have to go set the charges.
Oh, right, yeah.
And that one has a ton of weird problems where, like, you can win by going and setting a charge, but it's also a survival mode where once you're all wiped out, you're done.
Yeah, it's basically like the set the bomb mode from Counter-Strike.
Yeah, but, like, I don't think I've ever gotten through that one way or another, win or lose, where it ends with the bomb going off. It's always just the team dies. Because it's really fast, it's really brutal, like, it feels very off to me. But on the other hand, the survival mode, which is a one where you have a limited number of revives, but it's more forgiving, that one's really good, and I've had some great matches in
that. Yeah, me too.
So, but all of it I like. I like the challenges they've been doing every day. They're much better than the Crucible challenges from Destiny 1.
I think they're how those challenges sort of replace the, what were they even called? Like, the basically challenges in from Destiny 1 of the, like, you know, you'd go to the bounties. That's what they're called, bounties, the bounty tracker. Yeah. And you just, like, pick up either these PvE bounties or these PvP ones. And those were, like, fine, but, like, there were, like, 10 of them, you know, that's like, oh, get 30 melee kills without dying. Like, get 25 precision kills. Get, kill 10 Vex Majors. And then there was, like, those are all the PvE ones because I play more PvE. But there was, like, equivalent, like, PvP ones that's like, these are the same ones over and over
again. And the PvP ones were ridiculous.
Yeah.
Often. Like, they were like, well, I'm never going to do that. Like, that's just... Yeah, so no, I've liked them. I do, well, talking about that, like a UI thing, is the challenges, I love them. I love the whole challenge system that they're just automatically there, and you can track them very easily. It sucks that the only way to see them is to bring up Ghost.
Yeah.
Because oftentimes, if there's anything in the right-hand corner of your screen, you can't bring it up.
Yeah, I feel like that's definitely something that's going to be patched at some point. Especially, like, the thing that's the most ridiculous is if you have, like, a glimmer thing that's just this, like, tiny, barely even notice marker on the screen that, like, you don't even need to notice because who gives a fuck, I got some glimmer or gray.
Yeah.
Like, that will make it so that the challenge thing does not pop up.
And more importantly, I want to be able to see the challenges from the destination tracker, from the guide. Because, like, oftentimes I'll go into Crucible, you don't know the challenges until you start a match, but I need to set, like, what weapon I'm going to use, what class I'm going to use, and that's often decided by the challenges.
Yeah.
So... I just wish you, again, that's an easily fixable problem.
That's something I imagine they're going to, like, patch within a month. That is, like, because those are two pretty obvious things. But, like, with that, like, the challenges, one thing I do love about them, because it's both true of, like, the Strike ones and the Crucible ones in particular, is that they do have a level of specificity to them that the Bounty ones never had in Destiny 1. So it does force you to, like, actually substantively change the way you're playing. And it will make me be like, oh, like, you know, I usually don't use my gunslinger class that much because I'm playing the hunter. But I have a, like, you know, get these many kills with, like, the golden gun in a strike. I'll switch to that and kind of change my gear around and play around it. And it's a good way to sort of force you to change your habits a little bit and make you realize, oh, wait, this is a really fun way to play this game. Because I think all the subclass, like, types are really good. But, like, sometimes... you know, I get, like, stuck in my, like, well, this is the best configuration for this exotic I have. So I had just been playing as the Night Stalker for a really long time. And I was like, oh, right, I barely touched the Gunslinger. This is a really awesome way to play this game.
I agree completely. Like, I had not been using my Void class much, which is the first one you get as a Titan. And that's the Captain America shield one where you can fling it everywhere. I just hadn't used it much because I thought the other two were more useful. I now use it because some of the challenges on the planets and then in Crucible actually made me use it a few times. I started to really love it, and now, like, the one I use least is the Arc one, but I like to switch between the Void and the Sun one, but I still like the Arc one. So, like, I've really learned to like different gun configurations and things, so yeah. So all that's great. the strike playlist is dead to me for the moment because you don't get shit for it. And the only two strikes I ever fucking see, and I'm serious, I have not seen a different strike other than these two since we last talked. The Inverted Spire or Exodus Black. Inverted Spire is fun. Don't like the Exodus Black one. And those are the only two I see. And it's really frustrating, so I stopped.
I don't think I've even seen the Inverted Spire yet. I think I've done all of them except for... Because that's the one from the beta, right?
Yeah.
So I did that in the beta. I haven't had that come up with the strike.
I really wish they had an option on the planets to like pick a strike you want to go play. Like just because they're all at the same level in the playlist. Just break them out and you could go do that. And maybe you have longer wait times, but it would be cool if that was an option. Because you could also bring your fire team into it and do it.
Yeah, because it's also just a weird thing of like it's hard to know... If I've done all the strikes and stuff, or I do kind of miss having some of that. Even though, like, is in Destiny 1, you only ever did that once, even if you did it at all, of picking the specific strike.
Well, but one of the problems with that, though, is in Destiny 1, they were at a much lower level on the planets. Yeah. Here, you don't get the strikes until the end game, so they're at a certain level to begin with. And you could even, from that, like, toggle a difficulty or something. Like, I think you could make that work.
Yeah, because I think also what you could do is have that, so you could pick that specific one... But then you could also just get matched with people who have picked the, like, just give me any strike, mega playlist, and there's no reason why you couldn't be matched with them, and they just end up in that strike.
Absolutely, yeah. I think, and I wouldn't be surprised if that gets added someday. The other thing is, Thomas and I managed to beat the Nightfall strike last week, which was, okay, I guess I have played a different one. This was not Exodus Black, it was the Inverted Spire. So that's what I missed. It's the only two I've seen. But so we managed to beat that one. And I did break a part of a controller.
Okay.
Jeez. Because it was super fucking frustrating. It was only the two of us because there's no matchmaking on the Nightfall. And it just like... I don't really like that kind of thing to begin with. Thomas really wanted to play it and I was the one he could play it with. So I was like, I'll beat it with him for him. I don't really like that super hard Destiny stuff. I'm just not into it. But like, it got so frustrating at some points because basically it was you took a hit or two and you're down. And by the time of the final boss fight, I was mostly just dead all the time and waiting to revive. And you have to wait forever to revive. It's a bunch of issues. And so I did throw my controller at one point, and the battery casing thing broke. And it couldn't go back in. Luckily, nice. I did have a defective Xbox One controller that I had. It was the first one I ever owned. And so I just took the thing off. But that part of it was still working, so I just swapped them.
It's one of the things of like I have a very like personal life philosophy of never dispose of electronics or like wires in any way because you never know.
Yeah.
You never know. It's like I might need this weird extra Xbox 360 controller that is mostly busted, but like someday, who knows?
Yeah. This was one I had gotten used early. It was actually before I even owned an Xbox One. I bought it used at like a GameStop or something to play Halo with Thomas on his Xbox One.
Ah.
And a few months in, like the stick just came off, like it's just loose. Like it's there, but it just is like.
But it has flaccid. Like no tension.
Yeah, yeah. So I don't know what happened, but I've kept it and I was able to swap those parts, so it's all good.
Oh, there we go.
But I shouldn't have thrown my controller anyway.
No, yeah. Because you're an adult, Jonathan.
I had like I have my couch is like a futon. It's got like a wooden thing, like a wooden armrest, and I just slammed it on that, and it made a crunch. I knew before I looked at it. Anyway, I was good very. Job. It was also. That might have been after we recorded the last podcast, so I was super tired to begin with. And I don't remember, but it was like, I did not want to do that. And I did it, and I shouldn't have.
It sounds like that's not the game's fault.
Yeah, no. I do, though, with the Nightfall. I want someone to explain to me why the Nightfall can't have matchmaking.
Yeah, I mean, it has the guided games thing, which is, like, kind of matchmaking. I haven't done it.
But it's not.
Yeah.
Like, the raid, I get it. I think at a certain point they could let us make our own goddamn decisions about what's good and not with the game we paid to play. But with the raid, whatever. With the Nightfall, like Thomas and I were saying the whole time, if we just had a third person, he could be an idiot and not in communication with us, and this would be a breeze because we're actually doing okay. We're dying a lot, but we're doing okay with two of us. Like, it'd be fine. That there's something like... And I'm a little surprised that Activision isn't making them... make some of this more user-friendly. You know what I mean? Like,
sure.
Bungie has some stick up their butt about this, some philosophical thing. I'm surprised Activision hasn't come and said, you know, this game like sold like 3 million people. You gotta have matchmaking. And like, we get the raid, we won't argue about it, but like, make it easier for people to play. Sure, I'm just surprised that that's never come down from on high, because it's at a certain point in some of these things, it's ridiculous.
Like, I will agree with you for the Nightfall. Like, I think like with the raid, there are a lot of concerns with like how then that would like... affect them having to like change the way they designed the raid to make it accommodate matchmaking, because then there's a lot of stuff in there. I basically agree with their choice with the raid.
Like, I think guided games is a great solution for the raid.
Yeah, it's a good compromise.
I don't think for the Nightfall, that's just unnecessary.
Yeah, I agree. Like, I just don't think the Nightfall stuff. I haven't done the Nightfall stuff in Destiny 2 yet, but based on Destiny 1, I don't think it was like, it was definitely hard, but not so hard that you needed like that level of team coordination.
I also,
which is the actual concern with like not with matchmaking or not matchmaking.
I shall say I don't like how they do the Nightfalls in Destiny 2. It's like there's this whole timer thing, and you have to jump through hoops literally because there's rings like Superman 64 to get extra time. And it's just,
you would not invoke that name so lightly had you played the game.
But it's just, I think it's, because I actually really enjoyed the Nightfalls when I got to do them in Destiny 1. They felt like a fair, heavier, like a legendary on Halo or something.
Sure, yeah.
This is, I think, kind of gimmicky bullshit, so I don't like that. But yeah, you know, I've enjoyed other parts of the game. I still think like some of the milestones, they need to get some more in there to give you more things to do each day.
Yeah, I really wish there was a daily heroic mission. Like, yes. I missed that. Most of all, like, because that was just a really good thing of if you wanted to load up Destiny and play it for like 30 to 40 minutes, that was a good way to just like, I'm just gonna like jump into this, play this mission on my own, kind of like zone out.
Yeah,
it allowed them to do like harder versions of the campaign missions, and I liked that as well. And I think like that's just a big hole that like there should be something there. Like there should be a bigger incentive and like something more for you if you want to go play the old missions, and I think the Daily Heroic was a good version of that.
I agree, absolutely. Destiny 2, still really good.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, it's like, compared to where Destiny 1 was...
At this point in its
life? Yeah, when it came out, like, fucking light years ahead.
Yes.
And it's the kind of thing of, like I said last week on the podcast, every game that is like this starts out and has a bad end game. Like, that's not... Like Diablo 2 got it with the Lord of Destruction expansion. Diablo 3 got it with like Reaper of Souls. World of Warcraft got it after like a year or two of it being out. Like, you know, that's like every MMO goes through that.
Right.
It's something you have to like, every single MMO or loot-based kind of like multiplayer focused game has had the same exact life cycle of anyone that's successful, so that people get to the end and then bitch about the end game until the end game is really good. And then they bitch about how the game is too easy for everybody. And it's like, it was a real game back when it took me like 5 months of my life to get to level 60 in World of Warcraft, and now these kids, it only takes them 2 and they get a fucking mount at level 20. What the fuck?
It's a weird thing where, you know, this time 3 years ago with Destiny 1, I was more obsessed with Destiny, but I would say
but you were like angry about it.
Yes, but with Destiny 2, I have a healthy relationship with Destiny.
Yeah, I remember you having like a problem with Destiny.
I played a lot. I don't even have access to that version of the game anymore because I play on Xbox now.
There you go, yeah.
So, anyway. Cross-platform play. I'd also love that at some point.
Sure.
I think you could do that with Xbox. Well, we know they could, but Sony doesn't want to.
Yeah.
That's the...
Yeah, until Sony gets a, like, economic reason to do it, they're not going to do it. And then it's the same... We were in the exact same boat with Microsoft last generation where they didn't want to do it. It'll never happen.
All right. Well, anyway. Last thing on the show today, Sean. Next time we talk, it will be October.
It will. Yeah, that's terrifying.
Yeah, I'm turning...
The slow march of time.
I'm turning 25, and I'm just sad about that. I don't know. It just... That's a quarter of the way to 100. That's fucked up, you know?
Sure, that's what... Yeah, you can slice that cake a lot of different ways. That's the best way you choose to slice it.
Anyway, but let's go quickly through what are the games coming out in October. I have my calendar, and if I've forgotten any, you can let me know. Okay. But it's a crazy month.
It is.
It's not that there's like 100 games, but the ones that are coming out, it's a dense month.
Yeah.
So let's quickly, end of September, this Friday, the 29th, we're getting the SNES Classic, which we mentioned earlier, and Cuphead, which I'm excited to finally check out.
That game's actually coming out.
Yeah. On Xbox, so I'm probably unless like it gets really terrible reviews or something, I'm very curious about Cuphead. Yeah. Because I feel like, wasn't that game announced like the same year as No Man's Sky?
Basically, like it was like 2014 or 13. It might have been 2013. Like, it's been a long time. I am at the very least very excited to watch YouTube videos of that game, even if, you know, if it's bad and you don't want to play it.
The animation
at least looks fucking awesome.
It does, absolutely. Let's see. So for October 6th, we're getting Mario & Luigi Superstar Saga plus Bowser's Minions over on the 3DS,
right?
Which I'm looking forward to. On October 13th, we're getting The Evil Within 2.
Right, yeah.
Which I would really love to play, but I haven't played Evil Within 1, and I won't have time.
Yeah, that for me is a very much like, I'd like to play it. It seems like it would be such a Let's Play game. Like, I think I'm just going to end up seeing it in some Let's Play at some point. Probably without even really attending to it. It just happens.
October 17th is a game I kept forgetting was coming out, but also for the 3DS is Etrian Odyssey 5.
Right.
Which I could have, like, I'm not going to have time to play. I wish I did, because they did put out a demo, and it looks amazing. The music is awesome, and it has a bunch of saxophones. So that's cool. October 20th is Fire Emblem Warriors for the Nintendo Switch.
Now with Lindis.
So
there's a good reason to get it.
I'm excited for this game. I'll only have, like, 7 days to play it, but I am excited for this game.
You should get it when it comes out and just wait and get it, like, in fucking December or something.
I want the special edition. If I don't have time to finish it, I can put it on the shelf and come back to it. October 27th is D-Day.
Yeah.
We have...
This is the one.
Wolfenstein 2, yeah, the new Colossus on PS4. Assassin's Creed Origins.
I'm fascinated by that game.
I really want to play it.
Yeah,
I haven't put a pre-order down yet because I just don't know what to do.
Yeah.
And October... also, we have Super Mario Odyssey on the Switch.
Uh-huh.
Which will be my obsession.
Yeah. It's one of those things that, like... I'm weirdly glad I don't have a Switch just so it's like... I don't have to worry about it right now. I don't have to, like... It's like... If I ever get a Switch, I could fucking cross that bridge when I come to it. But there's too many fucking games. Because, again, I have games I've already bought, like Neo, that I haven't even started playing yet this year.
So, did I forget anything else from October?
It's not a big month
for Nintendo.
Yeah, because Call of Duty is not until early November, right? So, yeah. Yeah, that fucking October 27th, that like three hit, that's fucking just... Because I'm 100% like Wolfenstein 2 is my pre-order priority out of those three.
And Super Mario is my pre-order priority. And we both probably want to play Assassin's Creed.
Yes.
Like, I might pick it up the same day with Mario just to get the discount.
Yeah,
and try to get to it later, but
I'm like waiting for the reviews on because I think there's like a decent chance that game's not that good, but I think there's also a decent chance that game is really good or at least like really fascinating, and it's the most interested I've been in an Assassin's Creed game for a while, and I have my weird I've got my weird Assassin's Creed thing, and I feel obligated to check in on it every now and then.
So what else in October? Is there anything else you're going to be playing that month? I have a lot. It's a big one for you because
you've got all the Nintendo stuff. Like, I think I'm actually going to use some of that time to catch up on. I want to put more time into No Man's Sky because what I've played of it so far is really interesting. I need to get started on Neo. I need to play through Hellblade. I would like to play Resident Evil 7 at some point.
Definitely be a discount this month.
Yes, and October is when it would happen. So if I
could Resident Evil 7, you could probably play in a weekend.
Yeah, that seems like that's a pretty quick one. Like, same thing with Hellblade. I just have to get around and, like, do it.
Man, so the big catch-up game I still have is... I have Horizon Zero Dawn sitting on my PS4. I think it's a lost cause. I don't think I'm getting to it this year. We'll see. I don't know. But there's a lot. I do want someone at Nintendo to explain to me why Fire Emblem Warriors is coming out 7 days before Mario.
It's such a fucking bad spot for that game. That's one of those games that's like, you can put it out anywhere.
Yeah.
You don't need to compete in this fucking fuckfest that is October. Go somewhere else. Go to, like, late November, early December. Like, wait until, like, early next year in January. Put it somewhere else.
If that game was the first week of December, I'd be so excited for it.
Yeah, it's like Yakuza 0 and Gravity Rush 2 earlier this year. Even, like, Horizon. Like, they had, in Resident Evil 7, like, they had, like, January and February. Those four games had them completely to themselves. It's like, can you imagine if Yakuza 0 and Gravity Rush 2 had come out in fucking, like, this October? I would have never played either of those games.
Yeah, it's a weird thing, and I want to play it. It's the Switch, so like, you know, being able to take it around and stuff like that makes it a little easier to multitask with games like that. It's just that the fact that the very next game coming out is also the Switch.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, I think I can probably like clear the campaign in that in a week, and then I can play Mario and come back to Warriors for other stuff eventually.
Sure.
But I don't know. Warriors also already has a full DLC slate announced. Cause,
true, yeah. Because it's a Musou game, so
yeah.
It's got to have all the weird costumes.
Did you hear? I read an interesting story about Dynasty Warriors 9, which is coming out next year. It has like a fully playable version of China in it.
It's going open world and all this crazy shit.
Looks really cool.
Uh-huh.
So I'm glad. It sounds like we're going to be getting that. So
I'll play that. I guess I'm the guy who plays those games now. That just happens.
I'll play it too if I like this Fire Emblem one because it's a Musou game. But yeah, that's October. That's how we're going to divide and conquer that.
Yeah. I would like to in that early part of October eat into some of my backlog. We'll see how well that actually goes.
Yeah. So we'll see. Thank you guys. I think this was a really fun podcast.
Yeah, we got to talk about a lot of stuff. We got a big topic off our chest.
Yes.
You know, the N64 Classic. Like, that was just, like, burning a hole in my heart. I know.
There were highs. There were lows. This is the loosest podcast we've done in months, and I actually like that.
It feels like it's a nice way to unwind after, like Twin Peaks The Return so took over this podcast for such a long time.
I mean, we've
talked about this. It's liberating to take it back.
We've talked about this a lot off the air. This year was Persona 5 into Doctor Who into Twin Peaks with overlap on all of those. And that just meant that we were very rigid in what we had to talk about each week. And it's, I don't know, this was nice.
Yeah, we just get to talk about whatever the fuck we want to talk about. If we want to talk about Agent Cody Banks and Spy Kids, like, that's welcome to next week on the podcast.
Next week on the podcast, Agent Cody Banks 2, Destination London, co-starring Anthony Anderson, is going to be our watch of the week.
How do you remember so much about that movie? That you can identify any actor in that movie other than fucking Frankie Muniz. What is wrong with you?